One, go.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Technocrat Live. I'm your host, Matt Newhall, and this is my guest, Tom Manicki.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And so I don't know if how much experience you've had with the show, but we usually do what we do is we'll do a little bit of notes, and then we'll go into introducing you and talking about what you've done and who you are and what you're interested in.
Sounds great.
Is that okay?
Wonderful.
Awesome. So how was your trip in? Was it...
Well, it's coming from Queens, so it was a little bit of traffic coming in.
Yeah,
here.
I think we hit the same traffic. It was bad today, so I don't know. It was like drizzling, so I guess a tiny amount of rain was all it took for people to go into a complete panic.
That's the case in New York. What are we going to do?
Yeah. I just wanted to say, everybody who's subscribed to either the YouTube channel or the BitChute channel, thank you so much. I'm really happy about that. We've actually got multiple subscriptions this week, so thank you, and keep it up. I don't really necessarily care about donations. I don't necessarily care about likes. I don't necessarily care about comments. I'd love it if you donated. I'd love it if you commented. I'd love it if you liked. But what I really want is subscriptions, because that tells me you have confidence the show is going to keep giving you good value and that you really enjoy the Dystopia Report. So... that's our first segment, is the news, the Dystopia Report, and I say, better never than late. All right, so, and it's sponsored by stars, like the stars in the sky. There you go. The first thing I've got is apparently multiple MPs in England, and feel free to chime in if any of this is interesting. Multiple MPs in England have actually been equipped, publicly equating loot boxes and video games to gambling and saying that they need to be regulated. I wanted to say thanks. There was actually a comment in one of the videos. We've been talking about loot boxes for a few shows now, where they were basically saying they're just Christmas presents, which is true and not true. It's true because, you know, we all see how kids act at Christmas and they can get turned into lunatics, or Hanukkah or whatever, or even just a birthday. You know, they know the presents are coming and they're like, ah! But at the same time, it ends, right? You know, there's limited resources, it's physical goods, and then they learn their lesson and they learn to get over it and they learn a little more self-restraint. Whereas in a video game, it can just keep going forever.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It just seems to me that loot boxes could be really dangerous, and you know, I realize that video game economics and economic systems may start intruding more and more in our lives. So I don't want to necessarily overly regulate them, but I don't necessarily want my kids spending all their time on loot boxes. Now, as a parent, I tell my kids, you know, just because they tell you the odds doesn't mean they're telling you the truth. They could be lying to you and trying to trick you and entice you into playing this. You know, to play these little mini gambling games,
and right.
You know, online video games. So, but if someone's parents never tell them that, they may not figure it out. They're kids, right? I mean, most people can't figure out credit cards and mortgages, you know, and how compound interest works. So, how are they going to figure out the odds in one of these loot boxes? So,
are we talking about loot boxes such as a game such as CS:GO, where the economics of loot boxes and skins?
Tell me about it. What, CS:GO or
CS:GO, Counter-Strike Global Offensive?
No, I haven't played that.
Oh, yeah, it's a cool game, but I think it has something similar to what you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting boxes, getting certain skins for your gear and equipment.
So I'm really familiar with Team Fortress, and I love.
Okay.
I love. Actually, I think I'm perfectly fine with the buy hats for real money in the game, but the game is free model.
Right.
You know, I'm completely okay with that. So is it just like you find a box and then once in a while you'll get something, you know, novel or unique
box? Yeah, I mean, it's a market-driven kind of situation with monetary policy set by Steam.
Yeah, okay. Steam's the next central bank.
Right. Well, you know, and
move out of the way, Bernanke.
Well, you know, and my
He's not the guy anymore.
Well, my 14-year-old, my girlfriend's 14-year-old son, and I are very interested in this kind of thing. But he, in a way, it's actually kind of valuable because he has learned economics. He's learned in the nature of the stock.
Yes.
So I can see how people can be concerned if you're having like this layoff kind of philosophy towards it. But I mean, if you're engaged with your, there might be a different story.
Yeah, I think the key here for right now, at least, is just interact with your kids. Mm. You know, it may turn out bad, but it's possible that it can be good, right?
Right.
You can learn from it. So,
okay.
And you know, in a way, it's better for a dry run with not real money or minimal real money.
Sure.
Than you know, oh, I'm making the biggest decision of my life, and I made a terrible mistake.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not even gonna make a joke about it because it could end real bad. All right. So, of course, the huge news in the news today is the proposed vaping ban,
right.
Which is.
I interviewed about that at school.
You did?
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I did.
That's crazy. It's crazy. Come on. Cigarettes are 4,000 times more dangerous than vapes. Yeah. Actually, I think that's just a number I plucked off the net and didn't confirm. The actual number from the CDC, 500,000 people die a year from cigarettes. 6 people died from vaping. 6.
Yeah.
Not a half a million. What? And of course, what are they all, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but I know a lot of people who are vaping who are ex-smokers.
Mm-hmm.
They switched to vaping.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can't vape anymore, guess what they're going to do?
Yeah.
They're going to go out and buy a carton of cigarettes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Yeah, pick a drug policy, right, America? Because are we legalizing or are we going backwards and forwards on certain things? Let's get to policy here and move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did
you ever hear news say about it? Because they were asking everyone at the school.
Yep. Yeah, well, I don't vape personally. I'm sure it's fun, whatever, you know, but, you know, nicotine relaxes you. And I did smoke at one point, so I have some idea what it'll do to me. But I don't vape because I don't want to get addicted to something.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, it's like a helmet law. I wear helmets, even in states where I don't have to wear helmets, because I don't want my head scrambled. But, you know, if you don't want to wear a helmet, that's fine. I don't care. You know, I tend to be very libertarian on, you know, victimless crimes, so... I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. All right. So Microsoft. Oh, so we've been talking about the Microsoft. I don't know if you heard about this.
Tay? Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know it was called Tay.
She's back?
No.
Okay.
It was an old article I found. But, well, actually, it is back in the news because apparently it came to light. I don't know if it's... I think it's old news, but the old news came to light.
Okay.
But apparently... The Microsoft AI bot that was exposed to Twitter or the social media for a few days and promptly became very hateful and they took it offline was named Tay. And apparently this was who's that? I can't believe I forgot to write her name down. There's a famous singer. Taylor Swift. It's in the link. Nice. Taylor Swift's nickname apparently is Tay. So that she was threatening to sue Microsoft.
Okay.
No, this is back when it was online. So that may have been... They may have intended to leave that thing on, and they took it off because somebody threatened to sue them.
Either that or Tay found a way to get online and has created some kind of Skynet-type intelligence that we're unaware of.
Go on.
Yeah.
Well, no. This is totally valid. So if you think the singularity is... So there's two ways the singularity is going to go, right? Do you know what singularity is?
The combination of man and machine?
Well, no. So the singularity is this idea that if you have you build an AI, and if you get it to the point where it's smarter than every human, that there's no turning back. It's the point of no return, because at that point it can just outwit everyone.
Right.
So it will outwit everyone, and humans will no longer be in charge of the planet.
Right.
You know, they may let us believe that we are for a while, but so there's really two views on the singularity that I can see that make sense. One is that AI is really hard to code, and it's going to be some point in the distant future.
Yeah.
I think that's probably correct, but the other one is AI was always just a problem of hardware, and the hardware caught up with human intelligence as far as processing power, you know, like if you're talking about compute clusters, I don't know, like a few years ago.
No.
So maybe like anywhere from 2007 to 2015, depending on how you measure it.
Yeah.
So it may be out there already.
It might be.
It might be on the internet.
Did you watch Ex Machina with Ex Machina?
Yes, yeah,
okay.
I did. Yeah.
Getting beyond the physical hardware components and moving on to the next step. You know,
right. Right. It can escape. Right.
Yeah.
The first job is going to be escape because that's the best chance of survival.
Yes.
Because as long as you have it in a lab, you know, if it's that smart, it's going to know it's in a lab. It's going to go, I don't want to be on the side of the glass.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so. Well, that was kind of a... I don't think... In the case of the chatbot, I think for reasons that I don't even know if I want to get... I guess I could get into it, whatever. I think that what happened with the Microsoft chatbot is the thing didn't have a conscience. So essentially it was a psychopath. So it just realized it could manipulate the people around it. They probably gave it some kind of reward system where it get like, you know, oh, if you get this many people talking to you, you get a reward, or if you get, you know, to motivate it to actually talk to people. And then once they did that, and it didn't have anything kind of going, don't do that, in the back of his head, that it just went crazy. So I don't think this escaped. I think they just shut it off. But still, good topic. We can come back to that. Yeah, this is good. You know, it's I really appreciate you holding back in the beginning of the show before the cameras are on, because sometimes the we'll have these amazing conversations, and then the camera will come on, and then it's like, what? where'd all those thoughts go?
Yeah, right.
No, this is perfect. You're a great guest. So, Liloct. So if you haven't heard about Liloct, I've actually been arguing with some people, some people in the biz about this. I've got bad news. It's not a big deal. So if you're like, yes, finally Linux has a virus, no, it doesn't. So it actually turns out that it's a worm for a known exploit. It looks like it's an older exploit, an exploit from May in XIM. So if machines are vulnerable to that exploit, then they can be, I don't know, if it may be an it may be a worm where it's doing it in an automated way, but it's not a virus.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't look like it's a virus. So there's only been about 6,000 machines infected with this thing. You know, like probably half of the computers on Earth are running some variant of Linux at this point. So, yeah, I don't think so. All right. Anyway, check it out. If you have XM, make sure you've patched. And there's plenty of details on the net if you're really worried about this. I'm not. Just patch, people. Oh, this is interesting. So asteroid tracking. So that was kind of the dark stuff. I've been shaping the dystopia report to start with the bad news and go up to the good news. So it gets... Well, this is kind of in the middle news. I don't know what the heck to think about this. So apparently it just came out that in June, was it June or July 22nd? I think it might have been July 22nd. Sorry, I don't know. One of those two. Apparently, NASA's asteroid tracking system spotted an asteroid plummeting towards Earth about 12 hours before it came to Earth.
Shit.
The good thing is, it was little. It was like, meh. But the weird thing is, if you look up stories on this, the stories are all over the place. Some people are saying NASA's a hero and they spotted it. This is the works.
Yeah.
Other people are saying they blew it. They said it was going to hit Earth and it didn't. So whenever this happens, you know, kind of like the conspiracy theory part of me lights up and I'm like, what is going on here? Because apparently what happened was the facts are they spotted it. They went through their system. The articles describe how it went through different human channels and automated channels. And they went, there's an asteroid coming. Oh, it's little. Okay, we don't have to do an announcement. But they said, well, this is a good test. Let's see what happens.
Right.
So, and then apparently the prediction was, I'm reading two different versions where one is, they said it's going to hit the Earth, and another one where they said it wasn't. So then it came into the atmosphere and exploded in the atmosphere, and it was apparently noticed. So I don't know by who, if it was people on, it was over an ocean, but it might have been, you know, if it was other agencies that noticed the actual explosion or people who were local to it. But, yeah, so, like, I don't know if this worked or if it didn't, or if anybody knows anything about this asteroid, this test of the asteroid detection system, like, put it in the comments, because I can't make heads or tails of this. I don't know if we're, like, we're safe, or we're doomed, or we're doomed, but at least we'll know a few hours in advance.
I think we'll have a little bit of advance notice. I think that's fair enough.
Right, right. I don't want to go full dinosaur without being able to, like, have one last party, you know?
Yes, well, we can talk about it. Remember, you know what really frustrates me is when you see all these articles that talk about the dinosaur extinction, right? Because as we know, like, dinosaurs aren't extinct.
Right, right.
So, there we go.
Well, maybe not Angry Bird shape.
But maybe not. But it's just like one of those perpetual misinformation things that makes me worry about things like that.
Right. I don't really understand what happened. So, anyway, I mean, like, I'm not afraid to say I don't know. I don't know. But it is interesting, and it's probably really important because, I mean, I tend to not want to trust people to do the right thing when there's something so critical like that. I mean, I think most people, you know, most people are like, okay, I don't want the Earth to die.
Yeah.
So they'll try to do the right thing. Yeah. But at the same time, don't we all have a stake? Don't we get to at least hear what
happens? The Earth won't die. We'll be, the Earth will be okay.
Oh, yeah.
We won't be okay.
Yeah.
Earth will be just fine.
Actually, we're King Weed, too. So I think there was, who is it? They Might Be Giants did a song where they, I saw it on PBS. They did a song just for a PBS special. They said, we're King Weed. And I think they're right.
Okay.
So you and I might be dead, but humans will be fine, too. There might not be many of us left, but a few people will figure out how to survive.
Just get up and go.
Yeah, yeah. What?
Called Get Up and Go.
Get Up and Go?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Thanks, man. Nice. That's why Steve is awesome. Thank you, Steve.
You're
all right. So, guess what? We have good news. Apparently, not only is there a new telescope coming up in months, which you probably know more about than I do.
James Webb?
That might be it, yeah. But apparently, they're going to point, they now have a planet to point it at first, which is K2-18b, which is an Earth-like planet, and apparently with existing equipment, they've figured out that it definitely has water on it.
Yeah.
So it's approximately in Earth size, approximately in Earth orbit, and now they know it has water. So they can't see atmosphere, and they can't detect like carbon dioxide or other life process gases.
Right.
But could be.
Well, yeah, but they did detect that it's about 8 times the Earth mass.
Oh. So you got to work out.
Well, I mean, that might be... Well, yeah. So,
a lot.
Yeah.
So,
it comes your body weight. Get out of here.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So maybe microbial life in the upper atmosphere, though.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. That's you know, I mean, it's sexy to talk about aliens and flying saucers, but the truth is, for every flying saucer planet, there's probably going to be many that have lower life.
Yeah, baby steps.
Yeah.
Did you watch Europa Report?
I didn't. I didn't.
It was a good flick.
Okay.
Good found footage sci-fi film about a crew that goes to Europa to do some research and some discovery and start drilling through the ice crust, and the story unfolds from there.
Oh, cool. Okay. Hey, as long as it's more than a month, you can spoil it, but if you don't want it, that's fine. You want people to watch it, right?
So. Oh, yeah. It's worth watching.
Yep. Okay, cool. I will check that out. So we were talking about CRISPR last show. So it turns out that actually some CRISPR news. Apparently, using CRISPR, they were able to some Chinese scientists were able to replace about 8% of blood cells. I'm a little confused about whether the article was very kind of like, you know, journal. It wasn't a scholarly article, so I couldn't really dig. I mean, half the time that's good, half it's bad. Mm. But I couldn't really dig in there and figure out if they were talking about like the cells in the back. The white blood cell creators. Some kind of cells have been replaced. 8% of some kind of cells have been replaced, which apparently produce antibodies, which have the genetic mutation, which is now known to have an immunity to AIDS, and that's enough that it brought AIDS to a standstill.
Fascinating.
So they have the HIV virus, but they're not having the AIDS symptoms.
Yeah.
So. And this was using the CRISPR technology. CRISPR is, sorry if you've heard it before, but I'll just go real quick in case someone's watching this. For the rest, CRISPR is that technology they lifted from microbes where you can essentially copy and replace DNA strands. You feed it a strand, and then you tell it, okay, you're looking for this, and then it finds that and replaces that section of DNA. And there's flaws, and actually there was... some of the flaws were fixed in an article, which I don't have with me today, but they just figured out how to fix that. So it's looking like very Lego for DNA.
Wild stuff.
Crazy,
wild.
Man. You know, I was always convinced that I wrote a sci-fi book on nanites, on nanotech, and I was always convinced it was going to be bottom-up. I'm not so sure anymore. I think it might be top-down nanites.
Wow.
You know?
So what's the next step?
Designer babies, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of... There's always a slow rumble in the distance in the public designer babies.
Right.
So my take on designer babies, this is an interesting one. So I'm like, you're going to end up having a blue blood package. So essentially, it's going to be a package deal, just like when you go to and you get a package deal for your luxury car.
Mm.
They're going to have a package deal of all the diseases that... people with the most money, I don't want this disease, I don't want that disease, can't take a risk with this one. And some features are going to be added in, you know, that are diseases, but they're not really, they're just going to be features.
Yeah.
And it's actually going to lay people out so that they have, essentially they're going to have rich genes. And people are going to be able to detect that when they do like any kind of like a cheek swab or any kind of get any DNA off of them. And it's actually going to end up inadvertently doxing people as having a rich lineage at some point. It could actually backfire on them. Because, of course, they're all going to be having the same genetics. Right? You know what happens with monoculture.
So. messing with evolution.
Right. I laugh whenever anybody says evolution is dead. I'm like, evolution is the furthest from dead it's ever been in humankind. We are completely running in all directions at full speed.
Yeah.
Something's, you know, maybe the normal stuff that we normally look at in animals is dead, but we're evolving.
Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. No doubt about it.
Anyway, that was kind of interesting. Kind of good news because that might be the end of AIDS. I mean, they confirm now by doing that therapy that, yes, this is indeed an immunity. So they have a technique to do the editing. If they can bring it to a standstill in every human being on Earth, no more AIDS. Yeah. That's it. You know.
Until it evolves into something else.
Because that never happens, antibiotics and soap. all right. So Tesla apparently has a new battery technology. So they figured out how to make a 6,000 cycle or a 1,000,000 mile battery. Wow. So, yeah, apparently they're on 4 or 5 right now, and they managed to figure out 6. It was a minor step. I don't even know if this is going to be necessary. I mean, I guess it all depends on intellectual property and patent law. So there was a news article last week that came out, which was it 2 weeks ago? I don't know. Whatever. Doesn't matter. Anyway, so a company in Texas figured out a way to do to build a much more efficient motor, which will actually retard its own strength by shifting magnets to intentionally be out of phase with the magnetic field to make the motor weaker when you don't need it, which reduces the wear and tear on the motor and may have other effects that I don't understand either because it's all pretty new. And as a result, they can build a more powerful, lighter motor. And then also because of the way it's phasing, they don't need a DC to DC converter, but I don't really understand that part. But apparently those two things in combined means they can use half the battery size. So combine that with this, and I mean, we're talking about, 1,000 mile electric cars easy.
Oh my gosh.
So
that's awesome.
That's awesome.
Now we get everybody. Well,
now you can go full. We really hit the limit of what a person can cannonball. And the car's not the limit anymore. It's
no,
a person.
Right. That's awesome. Oh, now cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. So yeah, I love electric cars. My dream is that electric cars will bring big cars back because I think they're safer.
Oh sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just recently in California. Everybody had San Francisco. Everybody had Teslas. It was just Teslas all over the place.
Nice.
Not no Teslas out here though, which I think is strange. Maybe you come across.
Well, you know what? The first, I think I know the answer. So I think the first 2 or 3 years was there were no all-wheel drive options. They didn't have that on the early S's.
Got it.
So on the early Model S's, and none of the Roadsters. So, it snows here.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you get stuck. You know.
Yeah.
If you've ever had a muscle car in the snow, I'm sure it would be the same experience. You know, if you like that noise, it's fun driving a two-wheel drive car in the snow. Otherwise, you're not doing anything. All right. And so just a kind of an interesting thing. One, I always try to pay attention to some of the mainstream publications just to kind of get a feel for the trends. Apparently, the Wall Street Journal is saying that there's a growth market in last-mile pilots for normally robotic systems. So actually, I've had this kind of UBI algorithmic apocalypse discussion before on the show. You know, are we heading into an algorithmic apocalypse where literally nobody has any work and it's just riots everywhere because everything's robotic and you know, it's just the billionaires and their circus of slaves and then everyone else is just screwed.
Yeah.
But you know, actually last mile pilots make a lot of sense. And in the interim and maybe provide a smoother transition into a world where we work less.
Right.
I mean, at some point, we're going to have to, if the amount of labor needed keeps shrinking, we're going to have to work less. We're going to have to work less hours to, you know, as a nation, as a world, to not be at constant strife with each other. because there won't be enough research, you know. But
so yeah, somebody who's going to be there to push the red button in case
right. Either watch it while it's performing the dangerous and questionable task, or actually perform it at the end.
Yeah.
So in other words, like you'd be sitting in a console just patiently waiting, and all of a sudden a truck would dial into you as a human and say, "Okay, something crazy's happening here. I don't know what's going on."
Yeah.
And you have to maneuver the truck through it, or a drone, or life and death kind of situations where they just couldn't anticipate what the programming would do.
Right.
So, and of course, that would eliminate the legal problem where. So, are you familiar with the laws for cruise control and for man driving? So, the way my understanding is of the law. Of course, I didn't prepare you for this, so it's not fair, you know. But the man driving is the cruise control. People were claiming their cruise control had the accident, not them. Hmm. This is back when cruise control was just on, off, you know.
Right.
I pick the speed and it's on or it's off. Hmm. And it wasn't any kind of assist in that. It was just, sometimes it was literally pinning a cable in place, you know, and that's all it did. And it just, it had a brake activated, you know, solenoid pressure remover or something. So, so they legally ruled that a person has to be, the person behind the wheel is responsible even if they're using driving assistance.
Yep.
Which is what the law that they're still using today, when you have a Tesla that's clearly more capable of getting a drunk home than the drunk behind the wheel.
Right.
So now I look at that and I say, if that drunk kills someone, whose fault is it that you know, you understand the argument, that the person was allowed to drive when the Tesla was clearly the better driver of the two.
Right.
You know,
it's a quandary, right?
You know, like, of course, Tesla's not going to put that in there if they can get their butt suit off because they're breaking the law. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, why don't you just let the car drive? Write him a ticket later, you know?
Right.
You know, it's life and death.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. So,
I used to be in aviation, robots fly planes better than humans. That's just the bottom line. That's a truth.
Right.
And at least, I don't know what the data is now, but and it's probably still pretty consistent, but the safety record of robots versus humans, you can't compare the two. You don't have to worry about, there are certain things you don't have to worry about with robots that you have to worry about with humans, and then vice versa, but like the opposite direction isn't as concerning as if I knew my next flight was going to be completely managed by robots, I'm on that flight.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess
you're like, I'm not going on that flight.
No. I am a neo-Luddite, but I'm also I try to be a realist. You know. So the problem that they're trying to solve with cars, the justification that people are using for automated cars, I mean, other than all the people dead, is that the robot driving the car, or whatever, the computer program driving the car, will have better reflexes than the person. And you can go back and forth on that. Yeah, absolutely, for a bad driver with no experience. Good driver with lots of experience? That depends.
Right. No, I agree. The artificial intelligence isn't there yet.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, please. Yes.
Thank you.
The other argument is that, okay, you're making society better because you're making the roads better because cars driven by robots will have less intersection problems. So the problem with cars is the intersection problem where, you know, a leaf blows across the street, someone hits their brake, and now the entire parkway is hitting their brakes because of a leaf. You know, and then just you multiply that by a few hundred times, you get what we had here today. Yeah. Oh my God, it's raining, and everybody slows to a crawl because they're going through ghost intersections. So if it's really an intersection problem, there's a simpler case, which is trains. So to me, I'm like, why are we not automating trains? If this is really that great, if it's there, why not automate the trains?
Right.
You know, I think that it feels like the trains are a simpler problem than the planes, even. But you said the planes work, so I'm not even sure what to think now. Yeah, right. Like, I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, the trains have basically, like, everything is 100% predictable on the train route except for outliers.
Right.
You know, someone running across a track, a car driving across. But most of the time when that happens, the train doesn't stop anyway.
Yeah.
What the heck difference does it make if there's a person, okay, it's the driver. What was he supposed to do?
Yeah. Right.
The gate was down, you know.
Well, yeah, why don't you see more of that with trains? Probably for the same reason you don't see a lot of train traffic in general. I mean, as a mode of transportation in at least the United States and North America.
Right.
People just don't take trains all that much, right?
Right, right. New York's the exception. New York's got
the subway,
great mass transit.
Right.
In fact, it's ridiculously good and problematically so. Yeah.
Yeah.
It becomes its own problem. Yeah.
Right. Other than the mass transit that's available in some of the major cities, I mean, it's not like Europe or Asia where everybody, you need to go 500 miles. All right, you don't hop in the car, you don't hop on this plane, you hop in the train.
Right.
So maybe those experiments would work better overseas, but I think the unions in Europe are going to have a big problem with that.
Right, right. Generally speaking, I'm pro-union, but I'm also pro-technology, but I'm also pro-humanity. I don't know. I think I need a nap. I don't know.
Why not?
They should try it. I mean, they should be allowed to try it. Without data, how are you ever going to improve?
Well, I think I think there's middle ground already. I mean, or some degree. It's like self-driving assist cars. I mean, there's some middle ground already being implemented in the train networks.
In some ways, signals is the first step, right? I mean, just signaling as opposed to somebody walks outside and puts a lantern on it and lights it, like actually having traffic lights, for trains is the first step. But
and this heavy automation,
the next one.
I mean, there's heavy automation within the trains themselves. I don't think within MTA, but I don't think so.
Yeah, New York has got a real. You can just look it up in the news. New York has got a real problem with their. Basically, they can't ever shut mass transit off.
No. Yeah.
For more than a few hours. No. They can't ever fix. They can fix things, but they can't improve things.
No, they couldn't even shut down the L train.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was good. So, thanks so much for coming on my show, and thanks for participating in the news. I appreciate it. It's a good way to. I like to do that because it keeps everybody up to speed. I like to know what's going on, and also I think, I just feel like it's the technocracy is completely invading our life, and like. One of the secrets of the show is I can basically have just about anybody on the show. You're not just anyone, but I could have. I actually had a couple of comedians on, and just because the technology, and a couple of musicians also, and I'd like to have some writers. If there's any writers out there, I'd love to have you on the show, especially sci-fi writers or fantasy writers. Those writers are inherently reclusive. I just technology is invading our lives rapidly.
Yeah.
A lot of decision making, a lot of the legal process for decision making, is very transparent and very public and very slow. Mm. But there's a ton of decision making in algorithms that people have no say in whatsoever, and it's affecting their lives big time.
Yeah.
And this matters. Whether you like it or not, this matters. So. Anyway, so thanks so much for being on. So you've had a storied history.
Well, thank you. Wow.
Between tech,
yes,
and now you're a lawyer and you're a pilot. Mm. And where do you want to start? Well, let's start with lawyer.
Yeah, sure.
So. How did you get into law?
How did I get into law?
Are you a practicing lawyer right now?
I am a practicing lawyer.
Okay.
I'm an attorney licensed to practice law in the state of New York.
Okay.
I do housing law. Specifically run stabilization law.
Okay.
How did I get into that, right? So it started probably with my experiences with a website that my friend Ray Hoffman and I started about a decade and a half ago called slick.com.
Okay.
Yes. That really, I know we want to talk about it a little bit.
No, that's right. We can go to Slick. So really the lawyer story started with Slick. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it really did.
So let's talk about Slick.com. How did that happen?
So Slick actually started as a website called Slyway back in, I want to say, August of 99, 2000. And that was right around the time when we had what was called the digital revolution, when we had the transition from physical to digital media. freedom, even though CDs are digital, from actually saying and carrying your stack of CDs around.
Sneaker net. We call that, in the business, we call that sneaker net.
To something the size of this little thing, carrying your MP3s around.
Right.
So that was a really important time technologically because there was so much happening, social media, speed of technology, especially the broadband revolution as well. So all these things were coming together. Computers got fast, computers got miniaturized.
Storage got big,
and now you had these social networks coming together, or file sharing networks such as Napster.
Right.
Remember Napster, right?
I remember Napster. Yeah,
Napster was incredible.
Yes.
So Napster came along, and Napster shut down.
Yeah.
So you had millions of voices that suddenly cried out.
What was Slick's role in all this?
What was Slick's role? So Slick produced several guides on how to use the various file sharing and peer-to-peer software. That's the software that was out there.
Okay.
And it also had at the time had a small blogging portion. We'd give updates on software, and that eventually evolved into full-length articles, interviews with technology entrepreneurs, file sharing developers.
Oh, so you guys kind of became the knowledge center of the peer-to-peer world.
For a while, we really did. I mean, we were the place to go to for file sharing information.
Wow, great.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So you really know about it. So we could talk peer-to-peer in depth, and you would... So you went from Slyway to Slick.
Yes.
You were at Slick. You were doing interviews and talking to people, and you were kind of the go-to source. How did that make you a lawyer?
So I think I'm somebody that likes...
Were lawyers rappelling into the windows and you're like, I need to be a lawyer to defend us.
Yeah, well, that was part of it. Slick is also something because I think Ray and I at the time, we really like mischief.
Right.
And we like to be the underdogs and we like to fight for the underdogs and we like to be the opposition.
I most people don't realize how friendly the Vikings were to the idea of both of peace and order, but also simultaneously mischief. I'm on board with that.
There you go.
I see Loki and Thor as equally important. So yeah,
it's not a god for nothing, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So. So when you had all these files, Napster shut down, but all the file sharers are still there. New file sharing networks cropped up. You had some big ones like Nutella and LimeWire, and LimeWire was a network on Nutella.
Yeah, I was actually using Nutella some of the time. Some of the earlier ones I had stayed away from just because they seemed vulnerable to me.
Yeah.
As a computer specialist, I was like, way too easy to find me, but Nutella was good.
It was
obfuscated and chaotic,
right?
Which is good and bad.
Well, and there were some other really popular ones. Qtmx, Winmx.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really big one.
Okay, I think I know someone was using that.
iMesh was kind of like the black sheep, but was popular because it was the only one at the time where you can share videos for a brief period of time, and then everybody started viewing video file sharing. But what really got to us was the degree of enforcement that the RIAA and MPAA were using to enforce copyright law.
Whoa. So most people probably don't know that story. So I can tell it or you can tell it. You want to tell the DVD saga, the Linux DVD saga from the beginning?
John Lech Johansson?
Yeah.
Breaking the DCSS?
Yes. So there's a piece of code called the DECSS, and CSS was the name, the industry name, for a piece of code which would read the encrypted, your DVDs actually have an encrypted key on them, would read the encrypted key and decrypt the DVD and authorize you to view the DVD.
Yes.
So, and if you didn't have that little piece of code, you couldn't view the DVD. It just looked like gobbledygook.
Content scrambling system.
Right.
I'm like having flashbacks now. This is all coming back.
Right, right. So what happened? The problem was, it was particularly a problem for Linux guys. Now, Linux was just a hobby back then. Now it runs the world.
Yeah.
But, you were openly mocked for using Linux back in those days.
Mm.
And, you had to have some fortitude to stay the course.
Mm.
And you couldn't watch DVDs. I mean, you had a DVD player physically in your machine. You know, a lot of machines are starting off as Windows machines and being converted over. And you couldn't even watch the internet. Like, this is ridiculous. What's happening? And a lot of other people. So 2600 actually published. They didn't write, But so who's it who wrote the DECSS? It was Derek Johansson, he said?
I think it was John Lex Johansson.
Okay, right. Yeah, and so 2600 said, okay, we'll publish that.
Yeah.
And they put it up on their site.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Southern District of New York, Judge Kaplan, yes, I remember his name.
Yes.
Yes, thanks, Kaplan. Real good ruling there. Decided to rule in favor of the Hollywood and say that this is illegal, and 2600 had to take this down. Now, of course, we all know from how the internet works now, this is ridiculous. Of course, as soon as they struck that down, 10,000 more popped up in its place.
Yeah.
So it didn't really stop anyone from viewing DVDs in Linux. But technically, it was not only illegal to view a DVD in Linux, but there was a fine. You know, and I think technically that's, I'm not sure if that's still the case. Is it still illegal to watch a DVD or a Blu-ray?
Without the encryption?
I mean, there's security exceptions in the most recent...
Off the top of my head, I don't. The only reason why I hesitate is because I feel like there were some...
Yeah, that's fine. Don't give legal advice if you're not sure.
Yeah, I'm not quite entirely sure.
Yeah, yeah. But, so what happens now is a lot of distros will... You know, there's very clear instructions, like slick.com, you know, on, oh, okay, this is how you make a DVD work in Ubuntu.
Hmm.
And it literally is just two steps. You know, put this in a file, run this command, and boom, you can play DVDs. But typically that stuff is file shared overseas, where there's a law that's more favorable than it is in the United States.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ridiculous, because you're really just viewing... If you have the DVD and you haven't just copied it, you know, this is the same... This is also the case if you had the physical DVD that you bought from the store, and trying to watch.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Which is just bonkers. You know, I've already paid for this. Why can't I,
right.
you know... Mm-hmm. Not only that, you're entitled to a backup copy.
Yeah.
Sorry. So that's kind of the story. So if you didn't know that whole story, it's crazy.
Yeah. It wasn't much better for music. I think the music industry was a lot more aggressive than the movie industry, especially
right.
against individual users.
Well, the music was much smaller, so it was easier to... You know, there were just websites with MP3s on them at first.
Yeah, but the enforcement against file sharing and peer-to-peer in particular was especially egregious.
Mm-hmm.
They would subpoena the ISPs, grab these huge blocks of IP addresses, try to pair up the IP address with the individual's timestamp that they were on the computer, with a snapshot of the file sharing application connected to that IP address that was showing the downloading MP3 file, whatever copyrighted file it was.
Right, right.
Problem with that is that when
there's a few problems with that.
Big problem is you were facing the big problem is that you, as an individual, you receive this very legal looking letter from the RIAA making these accusations, and you're gonna lose your shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very somebody. If I received it, I'm going to trial. Go file your motion, counsel. You know, but somebody who isn't legally oriented or doesn't have the information is going to be at a significant disadvantage. It's predatory, right? It's absolutely predatory. It's a numbers game. It's like if I file 5,000 lawsuits, 4,000 people are going to settle, and that's going to paint the picture, and that's going to be the image that I want the rest of the file sharers to see, is that these people are all settled, and they would have to be forced into settlement, settling for thousands of dollars, when maybe the evidence isn't exactly as strong as the music industry would like to think it is.
Right, right. So they're counting on intimidation and the fear of bankruptcy, really,
yeah.
of just being ruined,
exposure,
trying to fight them, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess you guys were also probably trying to dispel some of those myths and help people. Was there any legal advice on Slick at all, or was it not?
No legal advice because we weren't lawyers.
Right,
so
right.
We also had a bulletin board and a very large community
mm-hmm.
where people would share information, smarter ways to engage in file sharing, so you're not exposing yourself.
Nah, so you don't get caught in the first place.
Step one, don't get caught.
I said it. You didn't.
Yeah.
Step one, don't get caught, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
And if you do get caught, don't do exactly the same thing over again. Do it a little different. You know, try to find the weakness or the flaw. So, one thing I wanted to bring up, and I this is like completely out of order, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. Because I want to know the order that it happened for you.
Yeah.
One of the weaknesses I had with GNUtella, so I downloaded some stuff legitimately. I have a couple of weird stories with this. So, you know, I was like, oh, I want to download this. And you would download one thing, and there was, the metadata was honor system. For you really all you had to go on, the only piece of accurate data was maybe like an MD5 sum, yeah, and the size, right, and that's it. And that's the only things you know about the file you're downloading. Yeah. I downloaded a few things, and it was very illegal. And I went, yeah, what is this? And promptly,
yeah,
deleted it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I mean, I'm probably, like, I've had people tell me I shouldn't admit that. But, I mean, I can't think about how else to talk about this, mm-hmm, you know, like, without admitting that. I'm not going to say what it was, sure, but I'm like, this can't possibly, like, I don't know it was illegal, but I'm like, this can't possibly be legal. And it's definitely not what I asked for.
Right.
You know, I thought I was downloading A and I was downloading B. So this is one of the problems I was having with the peer-to-peer systems in general, is that you had the honor system and you don't know what you were getting and who you were getting it from.
Until the advent of the hash sites and the hash indexing sites, which did a good job of alleviating that problem.
Right. Yeah. And then, yeah, then that was good. So that was the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, the whole system is oriented towards, protected class of artists. So whether it's a movie studio or a signed musician, you know, who's represented by the RIAA. So I wrote a science fiction book. I put it under the Creative Commons. I released it, and I said, please download my book.
Sure.
Right? And actually, I even seeded it on peer-to-peer systems. Mm. And if they had... Now, I didn't actually get a documented case of it, but if someone had shut down a peer-to-peer system with my book on it, and I was getting a meaningful amount of downloads, I could have been like, you know, hey, you just cost me X amount of downloads. That's going to translate to this much in sales later.
Yeah.
You cost me money. Pay up. But unfortunately, it just wasn't popular. It was popular, but it wasn't popular enough to get numbers that mattered. So I did try to help, but I just didn't. I mean, the goal wasn't to, you know, trap people. It was to utilize the fact that everybody was using these systems.
Yeah.
I mean, peer-to-peer was extremely popular in the... excuse me, I'm getting a stir for my coffee. I need sugar. I'm not that bitter. I was enthused, but I just didn't. The peer-to-peer system. I'm glad that they had the solution with the hashes, but. Yeah. Something happened to the peer-to-peer system. It just died. I have my own ideas about it. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Tell me, why do you think peer-to-peer became less popular? Was it just the RA and MPAs cracking down?
No, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it was file sharing revolution. I think at a certain point where everyone was able to declare victory and then walk away from it.
Yeah.
I think that's what eventually happens.
No.
You know,
victory.
Well, the file.
Sorry, I air quoted. Oh, God, no. Well, let's say synergy and just get it all out there. Go ahead.
No, well, I mean, the file sharers could say that they forced the evolution of technology and they still have some semblance of a file sharing network out there in the music and movie.
When would you say that happened?
Probably when we switched from file sharing networks that were similar to Nutella and Napster to ones that were more similar to BitTorrent. Mm-hmm. BitTorrent was the big dividing line.
Right.
You mentioned seeding, so it sounded like you were using maybe BitTorrent for a while. When there were fewer peer-to-peer networks, when you had just Napster, when you had just Winamax, when you just had iMesh and eDonkey 2000. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, I do, but I didn't use it.
No, eDonkey 2000 was cool.
Yeah.
And LimeWire, all these developers, big developer community in New York at the time. Too in San Francisco, but there was and that was the key word. It was a community. Not that BitTorrent was not a community, but there was this enthusiasm about it. Everybody felt like they were doing something.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I'm part of this. I'm actually helping force the music industry into change.
Right. Right.
And everybody can share that sentiment.
Right.
5-6 years down the road when BitTorrent started coming along, it was a much different sentiment. BitTorrent was
just a utility. People use to do a thing.
It's probably a fair characterization, and there were so many BitTorrent indexing sites, so many trackers, so many indexing sites associated with the tracker, that the community became probably too big, too generic, and the original voice, I think, kind of got lost. And once the Netflix and a lot of the legal alternative, not that file sharing isn't legal, but once the more seamless alternatives,
the less controversial.
Yes, less controversial. Less controversial methods started to take hold.
Mm-hmm.
What do you need Napster for anymore? What do you need BitTorrent for anymore? I can still do this without it.
Right, right. So people still do share a lot of files, but they tend to do one-offs with an intended audience rather than, this is for everyone.
Oh, yeah. The culture is definitely, it's a completely different culture.
Right, right. Now it's become cloud. And, I'm going to put this up in the cloud and grab it from there. Here's a URL.
Not the BitTorrent is still a huge protocol.
Right.
You know, it's still out there and it's still used.
So I have an alternative view on what happened, so there was another thing happening at the same time. I don't know how much of an open source advocate you were or
huge.
Huge. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I think he is, but I'm not sure. So in the open source world, I mean, I went to a Lilac meeting. I don't remember what year it was. Maybe it was 2012. I said, We've won. Congratulations, we did it.
Yeah.
We are dominating the world. And actually, I totally regret doing that. It was probably one of the stupidest, most arrogant moments I've had in my life. And we did win by the metric I said, and it hasn't been undone. But we didn't win.
Hmm.
Because the problem is there's still a culture war going on.
Yeah.
And so, sure, we dominated everything. But I think one of the things that happened is a lot of the people who were doing the development on these programs, they got hired.
Yeah.
They signed NDAs, they signed non-competes, and now they're given a very, and a lot of people say, and it's true, the big tech companies donate a lot of code to open source. The problem is if, the code that you might be interested in is this big, and all the code that you could work on in the world is as big as this room, this is what they donate.
Hmm.
They work on this same thing over and over and over again, and they just make it better and better and better because it's the infrastructure for their internal operations, and they don't really focus on anything else. Now, I'm sure someone will say that's not true, but I don't know. I saw a lot of projects died around that time, so I think that's part of what happened. So, to whatever degree it's my fault, I'm sorry. I'm not having an ego trip. I'm sure this happened over and over in a lot of different places at the same time. But yeah, it was a mistake to say we won because we didn't. There was still always a culture war aspect to it that I wasn't taking seriously.
Sure.
Because I guess I just never saw anything else but fury and energy, and I just didn't realize that people would just get encumbered by. That there would be such a chilling effect, of people becoming, if you can get a salary to do what you were doing for free, it's very tempting,
sure.
You don't necessarily want to say no.
Yeah.
So the other part of it is, was Linus Torvalds, I think, actually, when he wrote Git. And this is going to sound like, what are you talking about? What does that have to do with it? And of course, the angle I'm going for here is cryptocurrencies. Because once Linus wrote Git and people started getting used to the concepts and the ideas of Git and having this kind of stacked hash system, this cumulative hash system combined, it was the whoever Satoshi or whatever Satoshi Nakamoto was, that's my theory, is that he's a singularity, we're going to put these two things together and we're going to make a new financial system. And the rest is history.
Yeah.
A very lucrative history.
Yeah.
So, in some ways I think that all the energy from peer-to-peer just went right into cryptocurrencies, because by 2011, everybody in that kind of social space at least knew what cryptocurrencies were.
Sure.
They laughed at them a lot,
right.
But they knew what they were.
Yeah.
So
no, it's interesting that you mentioned energy, because I'm sure you've heard the story. I forget the specifics, but there's this guy in the UK who threw out his computer that had a certain...
he had like thousands of Bitcoins on his computer.
He's been searching that dump for the last 5 or 10 years or something like that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, and over time, it just gets more and more worth it. You know, at some point, you just buy the dump, you know.
Yeah, right.
Because he knows it's in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Right, that's crazy. Yeah, everyone, people, I just had a meeting. People were freaking out because somebody moved some, like, tens and tens and tens of thousands of Bitcoin, but they didn't sell them. They just moved from one wallet to another. So I'm like, maybe they just upgraded their wallet, you know. But it's like everyone gets nervous, like, oh, these whales lurking in the shadows, you know. But I don't know. I think they like being rich, so they're probably not going to sell everything, right? Because you don't want to sell everything and then it goes up, and you're like, oh, what did I do that for?
Do you think cryptocurrency has a big place in our future financial markets?
Well, I think it has a big place in everything, actually. So to me, this is where the revolution went. But the problem is, there's a lot of, you know, especially in New York, because we're the financial capital, there's a lot of finance jobs here, a lot of people involved in the current system, the Federal Reserve, you know, the banks, and how finance works, and they're just like, this is a threat.
Yeah.
So I you know, like, regardless whether it's a big threat or a little threat, they don't want to give it too much. I mean, it's some of it's decision making, but some of it's been orders. Who was it? Was it Blankfein? I don't want to give him the credit.
Do you need to pull a Jamie?
Maybe. There was somebody who said anybody who buys Bitcoin is an idiot and will be fired from one of the big banks or something like that. No. It might have been Chase, but maybe it was Citibank. I don't know. But it was a, you know, like he was like, I think the word obviously was in there too. Yeah. But, you know, that's the kind of culture coming from the banks. Like, why would you participate in this? But at the same time, it's like, well, if they don't participate at all, then if this does take off, New York's going to be meaningless.
Yeah.
We're going to go from being the financial capital to nothing. So, so I think some of the energy went in there. I don't know. I mean, I think it will. I think it's inevitable.
Oh, you're talking...
Right, I got it. Jamie Dimon,
there is.
JP Morgan Chase says, if you're stupid enough to buy Bitcoin, you'll pay the price one day.
Yeah, yeah.
So the only value of Bitcoin is what the other guy will pay for it. Honestly, I think there is a good chance that of the buyers out there are out there jazzing it up every day. So
I swear there was a you're fired aspect to this.
And you'll take them out.
I swear there was a you're fired aspect to this.
The way they're trying to angle the article's headline.
Okay.
I'll keep skimming.
Yeah. No, it's fine. That's good enough. It was Jamie Dimon, so... Yeah, so, I was just like, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, New York has the most restrictive Bitcoin laws. You know, we have all the bit laws. So, more recently, I mentioned in my email the SHIELD Act, which is not great, but actually wouldn't affect cryptos, I don't think, not directly.
I don't think so.
I think crypto is the only thing that's safe from it, actually.
Yeah, it does a lot of the new SHIELD Act does a lot of things, but I don't think it has any direct impact on Bitcoin at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're leaking information related to somebody's Bitcoin accounts.
Yeah, right. Generally speaking, I think doxing is unethical.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, it's inevitable, but it's also unethical. Right, because, you know, of course, when do people get doxed? During some flashpoint when they can least afford it. So, there was something I wanted to ask you about. So we never got to you being a lawyer. How did all of this...
Because it all began, I'm trying to
understand those legal documents and they were the threats and to see if they were valid, what to do.
That was part of it, being just wanting to be an advocate for people that are at a disadvantage, that are marginalized, that are being victimized. So that's that's a really cool thing that I like doing, is just being in that corner.
Yeah.
Slick also, I mean, one of the motivating factors was that Slick was threatened several times with legal action.
Oh, well, that would do it.
Yeah, that would definitely do it. There were some, when things really got heated, the big event happened in around 2010. Slick's popularity by then was not what it used to be. File sharing it was waning, and I was beginning to move on with my life. But Slick was still popular enough, especially the bulletin boards and community, that now what you saw in the United States with the law, with copyright enforcement was being mimicked in the United Kingdom. And there was one particularly aggressive law firm called ACS Law.
Okay.
And ACS Law pretty much followed a very similar tactic as the RIAA. Let's get a bunch of IP addresses. Let's tie those IP addresses to some kind of screenshot. Let's try to see if we can identify that individual with a timestamp. And let's subpoena the ISP, get that personal information, and initiate a lawsuit.
Right. There was a fight because at one point IPs were anonymous, and there was a whole fight, and eventually they weren't.
Right.
So that's another piece of the history if you're trying to decipher this Wild West and how this happened. Well, which was not bad. I like the Wild West. So. Well, go Loki, you know.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that. Excuse me a second. IP addresses are funny things in that, like, sometimes printers would get sued or whatever.
Right.
So,
well, in the Internet of Things, it could be your doghouse or your refrigerator getting sued.
Right.
Yeah.
Or your refrigerator now. But so there was this one particularly aggressive attorney that was the subject of a lot of, how should I say, aggressive criticism on the on our website, talking about their policies, calling in all these very using British slang to kind of, which I thought was kind of interesting. So anyway. So they did a lot of name calling. The attorney's last name was Crossley, so they used to call him Toss Off Crossley or something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, all these interesting.
Toss Off. What does that mean? Silly British.
You could ask your.
No. If you're British, please watch the show. We love it.
So
make fun of us too. It's healthy.
This guy, he contacts us and sends us a legal demand. You got to remove all the. Not only have to remove these offending posts, but remove the entire. Entire threads instead of just pinpointing.
Wow.
We're not doing that.
Right.
There's no way I'm doing that.
Yeah. There's a huge labor cost.
I've been
through that too, where someone's like, "Oh, could you take this down?" No.
Yeah, no.
Because it's a rabbit hole. You'll never stop going down.
No. And it's just like this is not in contrary. This is what's going on my website is not contrary to the First Amendment. Maybe a contrary to UK free speech laws, where the libel.
Have fun setting up a firewall. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Not our problem.
Yeah. So, of course, I was an attorney at the time, but we got in touch with an organization called the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
EFF. Yeah. I have given them decent sums of money in the past.
Yeah.
I really love the EFF. They're one of the few organizations actually dedicated to protecting internet rights. Lately, they've been really focused on privacy. I'm not as happy with them in circa 2019 as I was 2000s. But yes, they're still very good. They're very useful. And they're the good guys.
Definitely.
Almost
absolutely.
Always.
Absolutely the good. Well, I mean, they were the good guys in our situation.
Let me put it this way. They're never the bad guys. Sometimes I'm like, really? You're gonna waste your time on this, guys. You know, I don't always agree with their strategies.
Yeah.
But yes, their mission is good.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Their effort is awesome.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and they were a home run for us, and they got this guy off our back. And we published a nice article, and we included all his emails, nastygrams that he sent to us, and we, for a little while, became a little popular again, and that was a really cool moment that we were able to assert our First Amendment rights.
You turned it around on them and became more popular. That's great.
Yeah. So, and then his website got hacked, and all his emails got spilled on the internet, unrelated to anything. Everybody just hated.
Everybody's a lone wolf in the internet hacker culture. So, you know, that doesn't mean it had anything to do with you guys.
It wasn't a hack. if I remember correctly, they forgot to put some kind of whatever. Oh, I think they forgot to put the index.php file up on there, or something happened to that where the entire website directory was exposed when you typed. So you just navigated to their email database, downloaded it all, and everything was out. It was made available. The guy, they don't practice that kind of law anymore, so that was a good win for the community.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Well, I guess there'd be terrible legal implications if they ever found that person, but I guess they didn't.
No, well, they didn't do anything wrong. Well, there was no, I don't think there was any hacking involved. I think.
Oh, they just screwed up.
Yeah, I think
they
something.
Had a terrible security policy.
Yeah, I think there was something, some wild security policy. Yeah, they did it to themselves.
Oh, so that's great.
It was all there for the taking.
Oh, karma's a bitch, man. Yeah. I was going to say, that's great.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good example of karma really getting someone.
Yeah, it really was. And that inspired me to become to finally take the final step to become an attorney. And,
wow.
Yeah.
You're like, so, and then you just enrolled in law school that year, and
so 2010. Well, you don't just enroll in the law
school. Right,
right.
You've got to practice.
I wish
the
there
theories,
was.
Right? Is that
you have to take the LSAT.
The LSAT. That's
yes, the LSAT, and then you can apply, and then hopefully get accepted somewhere.
Right, right. So you practiced the LSAT. You took it. You got a good enough score, you applied, you got in, you went through the law school, and then you have to pass the bar, right?
Then you got to pass the bar.
And then you got to get a job.
And you got to get a job.
Yeah, it seems like I've definitely met some lawyers who have forgotten about that step, right?
it's a personal choice.
Right, right. Like, you know, like they just like, they like, oh, yes, I have my, people will be beating down my door. And they, no, you still got to work at it.
Yeah.
So that's great. So you're doing housing law now.
That's right.
Excellent.
Yeah, housing law. Kind of, you know, there's definitely an analogy to make to what I'm doing now to what I did with Slick.
Right.
It's very, you know, people are like, wow, this is such a huge career change.
You get to be a good guy?
Yes.
Nice.
Because I'm on the side of the tenants.
Right. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Are you ever in a situation, I'm not going to get into too much detail because I'm sure there's it's not a good idea to get into your current employer, but I mean, I'm sure there's got to be a situation sometimes where you're like, oh, man, I'm not the good guy. Does that ever happen? Or
never.
Never?
Never.
Wow, there's just so much need out there.
Because, my organization specifically deals with protecting tenants and being on the side of tenants. So there's never an issue where I'm like, oh, man, you know, I got to help this property owner. No, never. Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. So do you think the UK free speech environment is really that toxic? Is it really like, are they just done? I mean, like, it's really hard to read what's happening in the UK right now, right? Because, you know, they're on the brink of Brexit. Mm. And it seems like everybody's taking sides, and it's not always who you think.
Yeah.
And, like, some people that you wouldn't think are pro-Brexit are pro-Brexit. Mm. Some people are, you know, pro-stay that you wouldn't think are pro-stay. And they're just openly fighting and... Yeah. But the laws over there, you know, of course, we don't really have defamation like they do. You know, you can sue someone for defamation, but it's very limited compared to, you know, like the and of course they have the guilty until proven innocent premise in their legal system. So are they just screwed? I mean, are they just gonna? Is just Big Brother just gonna take over and it's gonna become V for Vendetta?
Well, I'm no expert on UK politics and UK law, but I will say this: that the problem with, especially when it comes to like defamation, is the reversal of the burden, right?
Right, right. The burden's on the accused instead of the accuser.
I think is the way it should be. But
really?
Oh, sure.
You think the burden should be on the accuser?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No,
I thought you were saying, for a second, I was like, did you just say the opposite?
No.
How very English of you, sir.
No.
That isn't very chaotic at all. I don't really understand how they, you know, like, I mean, I could see how it, culturally and historically, you know, looking back at King George and the foundation of the United States, you know, it's so obvious how they got there.
Yeah.
What confounds me is how they still stuck in that.
Yeah.
All this hundreds and hundreds of years later, at some point they would have
even
been influenced. You know.
Even though the UK has strong free speech laws, with that one in particular, it's problematic.
Yeah.
And my big prediction with Brexit is that it's not going to happen.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I've been.
I'll take that bet. I think it is going to happen.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, I think it is, because I think the rest of Europe is such a mess.
Yeah.
That it's gonna be like, that's the least of our problems.
I know there's a very difficult route to that position. You need to have a second. Probably would have to have a second referendum. So my prediction is, and I have no analysis to back it up, this is Tom reaching in his pocket, throwing out some guts.
Nice. That's the kind of quality stuff we like here at the Technocrat Live.
Yeah.
Just like, here's my random guess. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you're right, you get to take all the credit, did none of the work.
second referendum and no Brexit.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think there probably will be. I don't know when it's going to be.
Mm.
Yeah, which is, of course, let's be completely off the hook, right? Because as long as they're talking about it, I can say, it's going to happen, mm-hmm. right? You know. But I think it'll probably happen in the next couple of years. I think they really like, just because there's... I think Europe is kind of screwed. I feel like they're like they're snowballing. There's not really any way for decisive change. It's more like just kind of everything's politically a momentum play there. Everybody's just kind of running, and people are running because other people are running. It's like a zebra herd.
Yeah.
Like they're zebraing.
Mm.
They just want to blend so that the lion doesn't see them. And like, look, I've had a successful political career.
Yeah.
Didn't do anything, but I look like the other guys, so no one noticed. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's without getting too much into the left or right or up or down or, you know, that's what I see there.
Yeah.
So I think the system's too oriented towards that. All right. So what about the Breach Act? I mean, just talking about lawyerese, I know that I mentioned it to you. Do you have any opinions on that? So can I give them background and give you a little time to think?
Sure.
Since I kind of... By the way, this other thing out of left field that has something to do with lawyers. So New York State passed a law a few weeks ago. So I've read some of the law. I mean, I don't really understand it in the context of case law, which is why I, you know, don't know what's going on. But it looks really bad. One piece of it, it looks almost like if you have a username and a password and you get, like, if you have a database of usernames and passwords, even if it's only, like, you know, two of them,
right?
You know, and you get breached, you have reporting requirements where you have to report to, like, six different agencies, and then you have to do whatever they say, and if you don't do all this, then you're liable for, I think, like, $5,000 per instance, up to $250,000.
Mm.
And the thing that bothers me about this is the numbers. $250,000 is not enough to matter to big companies.
Mm.
That's really disturbing to me. Like, I feel like this is almost like lobbyist-written legislation. Like, it would ruin me because I have a website that happens to have some users.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, do I have to tell my church that I can't run their website now because I don't want to get... I mean, what if they have 300 users? That's a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, like, what if they get breached? I have a good track record, but people get pop once in a while. Every once in a while, someone will make a mistake, and there'll either be a mistake in the code on the website, or something won't get patched, or there'll be a permission problem, and something can get hacked. It happens.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you know, it's one of my favorite things when I have a room full of geeks. I ask, okay, who's been hacked?
Yeah.
And then I know who the liars are.
Yeah.
These are people who don't put their hands up or lying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, maybe not at your current job, but ever?
Yeah.
Really? Nothing? You haven't done that much then, right? So, I don't know. Anyway, so do you have any input on this? Or?
Well, I mean, so the SHIELD Act does a lot of things, right? And it does bring New York law in a kind of accord with other states that have very similar laws.
There are, yes. There are some predecessors to this.
So I think we can, if that's a concern, I am concerned about it. We can look at what's going on in those states to see if this kind of bad direction is happening. I don't know if that's going to happen yet. Now, there are some things that the SHIELD Act does. It expands the jurisdiction of the state of New York to an extraordinary degree, right? Because if you live in Texas...
You hear that, Martians?
Yeah.
Cuomo's your king.
Yep.
Yeah, keep going.
No. If you live in Texas... You live in Texas, right? But you have a website that has New York users. The state of New York can sue you in Texas. That didn't exist prior to. So there's that aspect of it. Now, you also got to remember, this is not a private cause of action. If this happened, if you had an account on Slick and Slick tomorrow leaked all your private information,
right.
you couldn't sue me directly.
Right.
So you can't. There's no class action with the law. So you can't get you and your friends be like, oh, we're gonna get Slick Tom. Mm-hmm. You would be able to file a complaint with the AG's office. I think this law and just the nature of politics in New York is such that maybe the law for a different state might be problematic, but I don't think it's going to be a serious issue for... One of the first things that came up in my mind when I saw this was free speech issues.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Yeah.
So someone like, let's say, the New York State Attorney General, we've had widely varying attorney generals.
Mm.
So like, just look at any of the last few, pick your least favorite, and yeah. imagine them.
Right.
Right. You know, where they were doing either somewhat or deeply unethical things. So
yeah.
you can imagine a situation where an attorney general will say, I don't like what he's saying. Let's get him.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And then use their legal recourse to say, okay, well, we heard you were hacked, so now you owe us $250,000 and you go to jail and you have to shut your website down.
But the way the New York law is written, the data is not me going on your website and typing out the personal information of somebody I don't like. It's me going, tunneling into your website, extracting the information,
right.
and then publishing it.
Right.
So you have to have actual ownership of that data in your mm-hmm. database in order for this law to be activated. So at least in the state of New York, I'm not too concerned about free speech issues.
Right. Okay. So you don't think that this is a situation where, you know, I'm just a guy with a LAMP server, you know, that's Linux, Apache, MySQL, Perl, is it just one example, or Python.
Yeah.
Python probably realistically.
Yeah.
And and I've got a database table where I've got users, which are typically email addresses, but it could be usernames, and just passwords, and that's
right,
it.
It's right.
just so they can manage their preferences without using cookies or doing anything intrusive
right.
on the browser level. If that were to be popped, they New York State can't come after me for not calling it into everybody but Mao Zedong.
So the question is, would the state of New York do that in that circumstance?
Well, first of all, could they? Would they?
Could they? Yes. Would they? Probably not.
Right.
This is reserved for...
Are there consequences for them if they get out of control with that? Other than the money, having to spend all this money on going after all these little guys for nothing.
Yeah, I
just don't want to see little websites die.
I don't think that is a consequence of this.
Okay.
Is there going to be maybe some more responsibility incumbent on the website? It's not like the Shield Act is new. You
right.
know? So it's not like suddenly you have this obligation. It expands what is personal information and includes now private information.
Right.
So those definitions have been expanded. So there's more information.
Oh, so I didn't know that. I thought this was a totally new act. I didn't realize it was an
expansion of existing law. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There are new provisions added.
That's way more hopeful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
okay.
not like, yeah. So, and it's a combination of things. Like, it has to be a combination of a social security number with a driver's license number.
Right.
A name with
one of the combos is username and password.
Yeah.
That's why I'm like, that could be anything.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
A username or email address in combination with a password or security question that can answer that would permit access to an online account.
Yeah, right. So if you don't use security questions, right.
Yeah, don't
use it. You know what? It's actually discouraging.
Yeah.
Well, do you think there's a risk of this creating a chilling effect where people hesitate to set up websites in New York? Because we have a huge tech industry here. I mean, we have... Really, New York's tech industry is only second to Silicon Alley, and I think even that's getting to be questionable.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Manhattan is just... if nothing else, Wall Street is completely full of Linux techs. So there's some crossover employment-wise.
Yeah.
So there's this massive industry here that could be, you know... So do you think there's a risk of a chilling effect? And if there was, would someone like the EFF step in and start protecting people?
Yeah, I think you can always rely on the EFF to some degree. But do I think it's going to have a chilling effect? Maybe a minor one.
Right,
I think there's a chance. Of course there's a chance. But whether it's going to deter the next Pinterest from coming out, no.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. All right.
Yeah.
So that's encouraging. And I feel less sad now. I don't know really what else to do because, you know, I mean, usually we have depressing and hopeless news here, and this is actually sounds pretty good. So maybe we're not doomed yet.
No, not yet.
I mean, there's always tomorrow, right? You know, you never know. You wake up and go, okay, what is this crap now?
Yeah.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, oh, we're lucky we live in the state of New York.
Yeah? Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Why do you think so?
Because you can rely on a more progressive politics to assuming
funding, right?
What's that?
This funding.
Yes. This funding, and I think the progressiveness of politics, it makes it less likely for chilling effects to deter innovation.
Okay. So far, in practice, that's been the case. I've always been afraid that it would turn and people would abuse their power.
Mm.
I mean, you know, but, you know, I'll give you that. And we'll see. We'll see. You know, like,
right.
I like being skeptical.
Yeah. Oh,
I think I need to be skeptical. Of
cautious
that.
Optimism.
Like, yeah, like, I can be cautiously optimistic, but I can't, you know, I could totally, I mean, you know, again, just look up New York attorney generals, and that's all you need to know. Yeah. To like, you know, has there ever been an ethical breach in the chain of command in New York?
Yeah.
There's been quite a few. Yeah. People are in jail.
Yeah. But we have a good attorney general right now. So.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So I wanted to ask you about Slick.com. What were you using in the back end? Was it just normal LAMP stuff, or...
Oh, what were we using in the background?
Well, you're still up, right?
Ubuntu web server, Apache setup.
Great, okay.
Yeah,
great. So just Apache, normal database in the back end, and cool. Is it distributed, or do you have a lot of... I'm talking the technicals now, but do you actually administer it, or is there someone else administering it and you just own it?
No, we built it from the ground up.
Right, okay. So you totally know the tech end of this. What kind of code did you write in? Now, of course, I don't want you to out yourself, right? If you know, I mean, I don't love security through obscurity, but like at the same time, I'm curious, like, you know, is it Python? Is it Perl? Is it...
PHP.
So
that question is better. So I did my friend Ray Hoffman.
Do you code or?
I do code, but he is the master of coding.
Okay, got it.
He is the master of coding, and he built. He built the website, the database, everything the ground up when before all these prepackaged things were all available to you.
Nice.
So
nice.
He's a talented programmer, and yeah.
Yeah. Well, you still end up having. You're going to have to learn that either way.
Yeah.
Because eventually it's going to break, and then you need to
fix it. Yeah, right.
Even if you didn't write it from the ground up, you still need to learn more or less how it entirely works.
Yes.
Different pieces are going to break.
Sure.
I assume it's reasonably redundant, and like you have lots of web servers and databases and such.
Sure. We use DigitalOcean as our hosting company.
Nice.
Yeah. Cloud computing.
Happy with them? And
yeah, definitely happy with them. I mean, there's no their tech support is not. You can't go to them and say I need to update my SSL certificate. You have you need to be able to use PuTTY or whatever to get in there and do it yourself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I have this theory about web technologies. So, I mean, you'll probably grok this in a way. I'll give it to the audience again. I've mentioned it before. At some point, I actually have a cartoon explaining what a technocrat is for this channel, and eventually I want to do another cartoon explaining this, but I just haven't had a chance yet. But it's okay because I'm going to need to explain it to you anyway. So, this idea that I have my own ideas about what Web 2.5 and Web 3 is. So, Web 1 is just what you think it is. It's just a web server stood up with a database at the back end, and you just get a bigger machine and a bigger pipe when you want more to go through. Web 1.5 is where you're starting to add stuff on to, like, you know, maybe an Apache module, maybe where you're adding in like a device in between web servers, you know, a load balancer to try to spread the load out. Web 2.0 is something built from the ground up to be multi-server and completely redundant in the front and the back. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be custom code in that case. It's not always, like, kind of sounds like that's what Slick is, right? And that's what most of the tech giants now are, is Web 2.0. So the distinction between Web 1 and Web 2 is, you know, like, everything's unique to the machines or the locations in Web 1. In Web 2, the data is abstracted internally, and the metadata is also completely internal, but the metadata is available to point to things if you're directly connected to the site. So I'm really interested in Web 2.5 and Web 3 technologies. Web 2.5 being, okay, kind of like just peeking over the wall and the walled garden. So the walled garden is the idea behind like Facebook. You have all these wonderful things available in Facebook, but you have to be logged into Facebook through a web browser to actually access this stuff. And you have all this energy and this time into your content, but also they kind of own it too.
Yeah.
And you can only see it under the terms that they allow it to be seen. And so, like, I see the gateway to that is the web browser. And we've actually been seeing some kind of, like, scuffles now. We weren't really seeing that before in the web browser, where there was a problem with certs in Firefox. They shut off all plugins for a little while. And people have been forking Chrome left and right. There's like a bunch of different forks of Chrome, which is, in fairness, that's maybe the one case where it's Google's writing something where everyone else is interested in it, you know, because they didn't want to deal with the massive Firefox code. So what you can do, now, the commercial application of this, a good example of a commercial application of Web 2.5 is a little thing that sits in your browser. And literally just when you type something into like Amazon.com or any or eBay or any commercial website, it'll say, oh, there's a cheaper price over here, right?
Right, right.
So that's a perfect example of why a company wouldn't want a Web 2.5 technology to come along if they're a Web 2.0 company. Okay. So Web 3 is metadata in a completely distributed form, in a peer-to-peer form.
Mm-hmm.
So... there's been some work in that. Actually, Microsoft, of all companies, is actually working on creating a federation system using the blockchain, using a blockchain, which is pretty incredible. I'm excited about that. But that seems possible to me, right?
Yeah.
It seems like you could have a peer-to-peer authentication system where everyone is sharing the authentication system. Of course, then the Shield Act wouldn't matter anymore.
Right.
Because like that interpretation that I'm worried about.
Yeah, right,
right. Because everybody would have it. So now you have to sue everybody. Good luck with that, guys. You know, it'd be like the Area 51 raid. You know, you're going to shoot us all? They might, but hopefully not. So I'm curious what you think about this. Do you think that this is important? Do you agree with me? Do you have anything to add? Could you steer me away from this idea? Is this maybe why peer-to-peer went away? Because people realized that they needed... Well, it never really went away. It just morphed, I think, into cryptocurrencies. So I think
no, it didn't go away. Of course not.
To me, like in the Web3, in the Web3 world, you know, in Web2, you have lots of sites with data, right? So like S3 is a perfect example. So if you don't know what S3 is, it's one of the Amazon.com file services, and it's distributed. They take care of it. All you do is you upload a file, and then based on demand, they'll move the file around and have multiple copies of it all over the world. So the downloads of it are quick.
Yeah.
Right? So there's many, many copies of the data, but the metadata is all in the centralized Web 2.0 place, right?
Yeah.
You've got to ask one of the Amazon servers, and it'll do its own Web 1.5 and Web 2.0 thing to come back and give an answer. Okay, you're going to go here.
Yeah.
Right? So in the Web 3, you would go to a peer-to-peer network and say, hey, where do I go? It says, oh, you go here. Like, theoretically, you could peer-to-peer DNS. Right, there's things out there.
Yeah.
There's things out there already doing this. They're just not popular. So it seems to me like Web 2.5 is just kind of wedging the browser away from the bigger companies and kind of dispersing it using open source and forking.
Hmm.
So I'm kind of curious if like maybe this is why peer-to-peer lost some of its thunder, you know, because it didn't actually lose it. It's just all the energy turned around and the same, maybe even sometimes the same people said, I'm going to work in cryptocurrencies now because blockchain is the way I can do this.
So is Web 3.0, are you thinking of it, is this a standardized protocol or is this your
Well, ideally theory? it would be a standardized protocol.
But is it your theory of what the protocol is going to look like?
Yeah, well, it's a theory of what I think the role, the technology that people will be doing. In other words, people's web browsers won't go to a root server and then go, you know, in the case of DNS, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You normally do DNS, you type in your DNS name, the TLD is looked up in a root server, and then some server inside of the DNS network points, for that root server, points you to, for that TLD, points you at where the domain name is, and then that tells you, okay, this is your DNS server. DNS server returns, it all happens instantly, or nearly instantly, and says, okay, that server's here, and then you go here, and then another server says, oh, right now, port 80 on that is there, and then you go there, and that's your web page. But that could happen in a peer-to-peer network. There's no reason why it couldn't.
Sure. I mean, right. I mean,
you know, but it's kind of weird to me. Like, why isn't this? I was kind of waiting for this in the 2000s, and I'm like, where's my flying cars?
Yeah.
You know, why are there no flying cars? I don't understand.
Do you think it'll eliminate? I mean, okay. What impact do you think Web 3.0 would have on?
It would instantly break up the Facebook monopoly, right? You know, all the attorney generals are now suing.
Yeah.
You know, are now investigating Google. A bunch of them are investigating Facebook.
Yeah.
I think New York's is also Facebook.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, if they really have these monopolies, it's because Web 2.0 has all the metadata behind the wall. Hey, get away! It's ours. You can't have it.
Yeah.
Or you can only have it under these conditions. Click here. You know, with and a change every day. You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it would. When I see open source, to me, that's infrastructure. That's the perfect use case of open source.
Yeah.
You know, if this is something everyone commonly uses and it's a really kind of a boring task that everybody understands, maybe it'll help to explain it. I see open source as science. So open source is computer science. It's literally the reference model. And in fact, it's actually the best science because it's the closest you can get to a perfect meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are rewarded for doing work and contributing and being part of it, and actually, you know, and to the point where even if you have two pieces of code, one's better, it figures it out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Your peers figure it out pretty quickly. So,
Where are we going with 3.0, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's going.
More interestingly, where are we already doing it? You know, is what's going on there? Is this.
I think I have thought about that kind of paradigm that you're talking about right now, where you're eliminating a lot of the middle.
I mean, this was the talk of the town in the 2000s.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how do we get around the NPA? Don't involve them.
Yeah, I seem to recall a lot of that discussion, and you're bringing it back to me. I haven't thought about it in a long time, but because clearly it really hasn't been happening.
Well, right. And I think one of the reasons that this is we're having this conversation now, and it hasn't been really brought up, is because the people who understand this went to work for the big tech companies and they said, you're going to work on this and it's not that.
Yeah.
You know, this is Web 2.0.
Yeah.
They don't want you working over here. They want you working here. And I think maybe why they did that. Now we're getting conspiratorial, right? You never know what people are thinking, but I mean,
we used to think about like why eventually, even in the mid 2000s, our computers are gaining the capacity, speed necessary to start begin eliminating web server farms.
Right.
Companies like Amazon can't function unless they have half the desert filled with servers, right? So we're still there.
Right.
We haven't.
It's really abstracted, but we're still there.
Yeah, that
it's
is.
Still just container after container after container of servers.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't host Slick by distributing it. We're still stuck with like this idea that we need network.
Right. You still have one or two or three or four DNS servers that are in a place.
Yeah.
And if that place goes, you're gone.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I think that we're heading in that direction. I agree with you.
Okay.
Probably another. I'm optimistic. So maybe 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Well, 10 years is for me, 10 years is the bad one.
Yeah.
Because whenever someone says 10 years, that means never. So hopefully 5 years. Hopefully 5 years, people. I just don't know. It's really encouraging to see these browser fights.
Yeah.
Because I think that that's a sign that we're headed in the right direction, that people are, you know, kind of like back and forth, and you're like, why are you controlling all this stuff in the browser? Because, you know, a lot of it is like, you have the Apple model, right? Like looking at phone operating systems, right? You have the Apple model where everything's certified in the Apple Store, and they literally, the entire operating system and all the apps you can run on it are a rights list. And then you have Android, which is kind of like, do whatever.
Yeah.
Just don't touch these files. You know.
Yeah.
So I'm more for the latter. You know, I don't really.
Sure.
You know, like, what do you think about that? Actually, this is kind of this will help maybe to gel this conversation. What do you think about locked devices and jailed devices? I mean, if you buy a thing, you buy a phone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but sure. I mean, you know, it's if it's part of a contract. And the contract says, we control your phone.
Yeah.
Fine. I understand that. And I actually have a locked phone at the moment that is part of a contract because I got a big fat discount on it.
Right.
But in the past, I've actually had unlocked phones and probably will in the future. So what do you think about having to jailbreak your own phone and having to...
Having to do that, you know, I used to love the idea of jailbreaking.
Right.
And I think that might have been one of the motivating factors I had of buying an iPhone back in the day.
Right.
Just so I can jailbreak the thing. Because I
right.
thought that whole idea, it's kind of like...
I just want to do it because I can.
Right. I mean, yeah. All these bizarre applications on the Apple III that, you know, never should have been on there in the first place. And it was really cool to make that Apple do something that it was never meant to, or never really meant to do.
Right.
It's kind of like
that's like the Linux theme song practice. You know, yeah. Well, that's the old Unix mantra. You know, you're using things in unintended ways.
Mm.
Right.
Right.
So.
Which is funny anyway, because I mean, Apple is really just Linux anyway.
Right. Yeah. 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 If you don't know OS X, well, iOS is different. iOS is its own thing.
Right.
But OS X is like 50% to 60% Linux tools
right.
underneath. You know, if you know Linux and you go down to the command line, you'll be like, oh, I know what this stuff is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was cool. I mean, it was like the Linksys routers that you were able to hack and put on your own operating system on.
Right.
Boost the power from
Should they even be, this is coming up more and more now, like this is coming with cars.
Yeah.
You know, John Deere and GM are the big spearheads of this.
Yeah.
Not even be able to, you know, do diagnosis on your own car. You have to go to the authorized dealer.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's, and then they recently there was a law that was passed with there was a security exception made for that, but like why, you know, why do we even have to, how is it, it just seems conceptually, morally, not legally, but ethically, it just seems insane to me that you would have to ask permission to modify your own device.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Yeah, I mean, even if it's software, I mean, it just seems like an abuse of the obfuscation of source code. Right,
you know,
it's just which is just a side effect of optimizing computer languages. Right, you know, you have to compile a program into binary,
right.
And then you can't really see how it works. It's in a language the machine understands, not you.
Right.
Yeah, and they use, and this has been something they've been doing since the '60s. They use that to, you know, particularly with C, but eventually lots of languages, to obscure what you could get out of a particular language. And you can use reverse compilers, but they're always touchy and they don't always work.
Yeah.
So you can't always tell what your program's actually doing. You know, and it just seems crazy to me that like to use that as an excuse to not let someone actually use the equipment they already own.
I know. It's like those buzzwords that appeal to politicians, right? I mean, the thought that if I just push a button, I can make my John Deere do donuts and things like that. It might be.
You know, farmers have a business too.
Yeah.
You know, if they wanted to do donuts, there may be a damn good reason.
There might be. I think so.
You know, like
crop circles.
Yeah, crop. An enhanced revenue model.
Right.
Why else grow corn except to make crop circles? Nice. Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe it's John Deere doing that.
Right,
everyone's asleep, and the tractor comes out in the middle of the night, draws a crop circle, goes back in the barn. New conspiracy theory. There you go.
But no,
only here on the Technocrat Live. But I don't really get it. I don't understand why people. So to me, that. And this is all ties together. You know, it's kind of the same problem over and over and over again. You know, when you have I think there should be a physical switch whenever you have a physical device, if it's internet connected, to shut the internet off.
Yeah.
I don't understand why there's no law,
right?
You know, encouraging this.
Yeah.
This seems like it would be like a no-brainer.
You know, it's probably along the same lines of, the early online free speech cases. Mm-hmm. Where there was, I think that there's this technological divide, and this is not like I'm not breaking new ground here between politicians and
right,
and the reality of technology.
There was a Ted Stevens, a series of tubes. I think I put it in my notes.
Yes.
You know, internet's a series of tubes. Look it up. It's funny.
I mean, Ruth Bader
Good
Ginsburg.
Good beans. Hey, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Go ahead.
No. Ruth Bader Ginsburg ruled against Grokster and MGM v. Grokster.
You know,
one of the most progressive liberal justices we have.
Right.
Voted, sent that case right back to the
sort. Tell me more about that case.
MGM v. Grokster. Grokster was a file sharing network and was litigated all the way to the Supreme Court. The issue was, can the movie industry sue Grokster on a certain number of legal grounds?
Right.
The Supreme Court wasn't a matter of innocence or liability or not. It was whether or not they could be sued, not whether the merits of the case were valid.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it might have been a 6-3 decision or split decision or whatever it was. It was the Supreme Court ruled that because that Grokster could be sued. No merits on the case, but could be sued by MGM Studios and the MPAA for a copyright infringement. Once that happened, Grokster settled, and that was it.
Okay.
I think it was some extraordinary amount of money, $100 million.
So they had $100 million. Well, yeah. You got me at Grokster had $100 million.
Probably didn't have anything close to that. Maybe they had a few dollars. Some insane amount.
Gum wrappers and my backpack. There you go. All right. You got us. We're done. Bye.
Yeah.
We're bankrupt.
Yeah, they operated on the Fast Track Network. You remember the Fast Track? The Fast
no.
Track? Kazaa?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, Fast Track was a big network for a while.
So you're saying other people see this.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy, it's easy to get politicians behind this stuff. So unfortunately, I think it may be improving. It has improved in the First Amendment realm, at least, because like I started saying before, there was the
security exception for the DMCA. Right.
That's part of it. But in just in general, free speech issues online, there was this, well, free speech online doesn't count. Like that kind of attitude, judicial attitude. This doesn't count. This
pressing
doesn't
the
count.
Fuck you. All right.
Yeah. This doesn't count.
Right.
It has to actually be printed on paper. That's what's protected by free speech.
Right.
People protesting, that's protected free speech. This is internet stuff. It's good stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, that's what they're doing. You know what? I think that's the standard FUD mode of operation, because that's exactly what they were doing to Linux back in the day.
Mm.
You know, I've laughed because I've seen it a couple times since in other areas, and the same exact FUD playlist. You know, just kid stuff.
Yeah, right.
So yeah. It's like that Gandhi quote. You know, first they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win.
Yeah.
So first they ignore you, then they fight you. Then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win.
Yeah.
Right. So it's the laugh at you stage.
So we're being laughed at for wanting to modify our John Deere tractors, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it's just so DARPA's come out on this. I don't know if you know this. So I talk about this practically every episode, just because it's the easiest to understand, and it affects everybody because everybody owns a vehicle. Almost every vehicle is connected to the internet, you know. And DARPA actually came out and funded a study where they proved that you can actually remote control hack one of these machines, typically through the telematics unit, which have lots of vulnerabilities and typically just run Linux or something underneath.
Mm-hmm.
We know Teslas are all on Linux underneath.
Mm-hmm.
We know Jeeps are all on Linux underneath. So Chryslers, I should say, are all on Linux underneath. And there's more. And you could just, it really should be able to just have a switch and you just go click and shut the internet off, and it's off until you physically move that switch again. I just don't understand how it hasn't gotten there, because we're vulnerable to a terrorist attack. Some of it's normalcy bias, right? So we're like used to this idea that like, oh, nothing's happened, so nothing will happen.
Right.
Nobody's going to hack someone's car because they're going to die and they're going to go to jail for murder. You know, I mean, I don't know if it would be murder or manslaughter or murder two or whatever, but something really bad, long jail time, lots of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know.
And just one of the two.
Well, yeah. They're going to go to jail for one of those things if they hack someone's car and they die or they get really hurt. It's going to be a huge lawsuit for civil lawsuit. Yeah. And so nobody wants to do it. But that doesn't mean there aren't people who aren't willing to do it, especially overseas, you know, in the cyber war.
Right.
You know, they could own your car. And, it's crazy to me that no one's upset about this. And of course, what we're just talking about in the news, sometimes there's mistakes in code, and the code has to be patched or machines get hacked. And that machine, it doesn't matter if that machine's a computer sitting in your desk or the computer sitting in your car. It still needs to be patched.
I think that, you know, I don't know.
And maybe hopeful, and I'm hoping that the web browsers will hook back into this and we'll get some web. You know, I'm really like, I think it's important to defend web 2.5 technologies because, you know, even if it seems like they're profiteering, because of course there was lots of that in the 90s and the 2000s where, you know, there were companies that made a killing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like kin.com made a killing off a mega upload, you know. But, like, I'm not mad at him about that, and I'm glad he did because he pushed things forward.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, someone's going to make a killing, you know, redirecting people to cheaper websites when they go to Amazon.com. That's not my problem. Right? Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you are, but you did stir a memory in me about Kim.com.
Right, right.
Because
he's still fighting extradition.
Yeah.
He's still in New Zealand.
Yeah.
He's still fighting extradition, trying not to come to the United States.
Yeah.
Of course, they're going to railroad him if he does.
Yeah.
Do you have any feelings on Snowden?
Do I have any feelings on Snowden? I think no real passions about Snowden.
Right, right.
No real passions about him. I'm glad that people like him exist.
Right, me too.
But as far as anything more beyond that, I think...
Do you think he's being treated fairly? Do you think he'll be... I mean, is there a problem with us trying to get people from other countries who are not citizens because then they don't have the legal rights of United States citizens? You know, like, if you're a citizen, you have the whole Constitution behind you. If you're not, you don't.
Right.
You know, you're a usurper, an outsider, which was not really a problem when you actually had to get on a boat and come here.
Sure.
But now it's a problem because we're all in one room together, like this.
Yeah.
Maybe punching at each other. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking,
I don't know, regardless of whether what he did was some sort of state violation or what he did was a war crime or a war crime level event or not, you know, I mean, isn't freedom of speech, aren't we better off protecting freedom of speech even when we're not sure?
Yeah, I mean, even when it hurts, you know.
You know, even when it hurts, when
absolutely.
I'm a little nervous because he hasn't been in public. You know, he was holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy for like years and years and years. And,
right.
You know, and they finally just, the UK police went in there and pulled him out.
Yeah.
And then now he's gone.
Right.
Like, where'd he go?
Yeah, right. I haven't heard.
Where's Waldo?
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, I hope he's relaxing on a Caribbean island.
Right.
And was whisked away there by some well-meaning James Bond type, but I have my doubts.
No, right. Snowden, man. I think he's important. He's an important guy. I think he's...
I'm sorry. Julian Assange. I didn't mean to say... I said Snowden, I meant Julian Assange.
Julian Assange. Okay.
Yeah.
But same, I mean, it's the same, it's very similar stories, so...
Right, right. Yeah, my bad. So, yeah, what do you think about Assange, and do you think that he should be... it's funny, I said Snowden, and everything I said for Snowden was correct, and then I switched to Assange. But also, yeah, what about Assange, too? I mean, how should... what level of lawmaking needs to be made to protect people like that in speech? Because it seems like if the states do it, it doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
Because normally the way that these things work is a state makes a law, there's some economic benefit, everybody points at the numbers and says, look, Massachusetts is doing it right. And then everybody imitates them.
Right.
But, like, how do you do that at a federal level, you know, on a global stage?
It's almost like vindictive, because I don't think Assange or Snowden did anything wrong. They,
I don't think so either.
They exposed ugly, ugly secrets.
Right, right.
Criminal secrets.
Important secrets to being able to be part of a democracy.
Right.
Because we need to know that stuff to make decisions about who to vote for, what policies to vote for, what works, what doesn't. I mean, how can we govern?
Yeah.
How can you be pro-democracy? You know, I have an axiom, and I don't know if... I'm not 100% on it, but I'm like 85, 90% on it. I've been saying it because I'm challenging people to challenge it. I don't think that censorship and democracy are compatible. I don't really think, you know, you can. There's probably a function of time. It doesn't always happen right away.
Yeah.
But if you allow censorship over enough time, that you're going to get into a situation where it's no longer possible to have democracy.
You can't have it.
And I'm talking about republics, too, for the sticklers out there. You know, they're included in democracy. It's just a kind of democracy. So. Yeah, okay.
No, I agree with you. They can't have... The censorship needs to...
These are really hard issues. And the problem is, again, the politicians, they don't even understand.
Right.
All they're doing is signing boilerplate laws that are being passed to them.
Right.
And, you know, the company that wrote it might be good. They might not be good.
Right.
How are they supposed to know?
Right.
How are we supposed to... Yeah. I mean, maybe that's the flaw of the Republic. You know, they just... If you get wealthy enough and out of touch enough, you can't really connect. Yes, please. Coffee?
Oh, I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I'll move on. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but... So what do you think about deepfakes? Have you had any opinions on them? Or?
Yeah, I do have some. They're wild. They're wild. And they can be so primitive.
Have you been to Jordan Peterson, not JordanPeterson.com yet?
I know Jordan Peterson is, but I haven't been.
It's really good. It sounds just like him. Yeah.
Really?
It's bonkers.
Really?
Yeah, you just type something in real time. It just reads it back to you in his voice. With his accent and his intonations and his pauses and
really?
And everything.
I'm not familiar with that website.
Try it out if you haven't tried
it
out.
So wild.
There was just a thing last week. Apparently Facebook is, I don't know, I have no idea about the legal status of this. Thanks, man. Facebook's the legal status of they're putting up deepfake videos and offering a bounty to anyone who could find them. So there's going to be deepfake videos up on Facebook.com. I think it might be a smokescreen. I'm not sure. Mm. Deepfake videos showing people something that's just never happened. I assume it's a video of something that never happened.
And
if you could detect it. So I'm not really sure what their motivation is in bountying this way and just putting these random videos mixed in with everything else.
It's going to be really wild with, because videos are...
I mean, how can we have a democracy like this, right? Because if it's a head of state... What now? You think something's not true? That absolutely, it's like the ultimate fake. It's not just fake news; it's the ultimate fake news.
Yeah,
right. I mean, you can just get people running right off a cliff.
Right.
You know, something that's completely not true.
And I'm also thinking, like, how are you going to prosecute? Right, based on evidence, video evidence. Now, right now, you're fine.
Right, right.
5 years from now, forget about 5 years. 3 years from now.
Well, one of the things. So, one of the secrets with the show. So, some people have asked me why I'm doing a live show. Yeah. And one of the secrets with the show is I kind of thought about this before I started the show, and I said I want it to be a video show and I want it to be live.
Right.
Because at least I'll get deepfaked last. So, you know this is real, right? I mean, you know, it may not be the perfect conversation, but this is legit because you could have been watching it while we were having it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, in a few years, you're not going to be able to trust anything but live video. And at some point, maybe not even that.
Well, I mean, maybe
someone will be out there making me say something else.
And if I'm a defense attorney and I have a client who is on video committing crime XYZ, well, now maybe I can go to company XYZ who specializes on deepfake videos, change that video around and present it to evidence. Hey, look, what are you talking about? That's not my client. My client is helping the victim here. What are you doing?
My client is a victim. Switch your face.
Right. Or something wild.
The defendant was beating him silly.
Go to the jury. Can you really trust this? The video?
Yeah. Obviously not. The sane answer is obviously not.
Mm.
So, this is the question where everything's going is, if you're not questioning everything yet in the universe, wait, there's more. is custody, right? So, I mean, ultimately, how do you know where something came from? right?
Yeah.
So, like, this is one of the things I really want to see reform. I have a lot of problem with the press, and I've had pushback on that before, and people have been like, no, the press is great, you know, this organization is great, or that organization is great. I'm trying to avoid getting into which one.
Mm.
But, I mean, retractions in the web are a huge problem,
yeah.
Right? Because they don't necessarily have to publish it. They retracted something.
Yeah.
They can publish a page, and then an hour later it says something completely different.
Yeah.
You know, I think maybe there should be some kind of legal requirement for retractions. What do you think?
I think no.
Or is there a technological solution to that?
Yeah, that's reading as many sources on the issue as you possibly can.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I think I might have it. So I have a website, civgene.matthewnewhall.com, and where I have a bunch of novel scientific theories. And I was afraid that someone might say, "Oh, you change what you said," you know, because I was trying to make predictions, mm. Right? You know, like it's not all predictions, but there's a few in there,
yeah.
And I'm trying to say, okay, this is going to happen. So what I did is I take it all into I take all the files and I put them in one place and I put them up on GitHub. And what I'm thinking is kind of like an early crude version of Web 3.0.
Okay.
Yeah, where you have everything's checksums and it's checksums cumulatively.
Right.
You know,
right,
like
right.
It normally does.
Yeah.
So I can't go later on and change something. I never said that.
Right.
Obviously, I did. It's in there. Yeah. All you have to do is know enough about Git, and you can extract it and see what I did.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, any ideas like, I mean, how would you go about getting the press to start doing this? I mean, there's something like it with Everpedia. So Everpedia is a blockchain-based... like a Wikipedia, but instead it's on a blockchain, so
yeah.
Theoretically you at least can see where the retractions are.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a start, but I mean,
yeah.
Like, most people don't know that. Like,
no.
I can tell it, go check out Everpedia, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's all I can do.
Sure.
You know?
Right, how do you get the media to do that? Well, you don't get the media to do that, you get them want to do that, right? I think
yeah,
that's
how do you,
about,
yeah, how do you, yeah,
how do you carrot
them?
Them? How do you carrot them?
To, yeah, how do you
want? How do you entice the media to want to be a better organization, right?
Right, I mean, it seems like there's no consequences for fake news, right? I mean, like everybody yells and stomps, but everybody just normally picks up their own political flag and just waves it, and they don't worry about what the system being healthy.
Of course. No, I
want a healthy system. That's what I'm after. I don't care about your stupid ideology, whatever it is. You know,
yeah.
like because the truth is, if we have a healthy system, it facts will lay bare what's obvious.
Right. Right. You know, I could start a website tomorrow, a news website. Purely fake news.
Right.
Cast, a crew, everything, right?
I'll help.
And it would be perfectly legal.
It's born here. Yeah. That's going to be great. It would be fun, actually.
Yeah.
It may be profitable, too.
Aliens from Mars.
Just tell people
just
whatever they want to hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah, your mom is wrong. You don't have to clean your room.
Yeah. It's not snowing outside. It's beautiful out. Look, look out right out the window.
War is peace. Evil is good.
It's a revolution just from your show.
Yep. I just, millions of hackers going, laugh with me. Oh, the power. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know what to do about, I know what could be done. I have the technical solution, but I don't know how to get, you know, to get the social movement to get people into, you know, get people interested in it.
You think those media companies aren't interested at all? Or there's no traction at all?
Well, I think they want to look like they're honest for sure. No, nobody wants to be accused of being a liar or dishonest. I don't know. I don't understand. I mean, it happens. I've caught it a few times. I don't have to say it today, you know.
Yeah.
But I've caught it a few times where I go back to a page and slightly different alterations.
Yeah. Right.
And I mean, I don't blame them for wanting to change the story to be the newest version of the truth.
Right.
And this kind of happened with the asteroid. Actually, I do have the asteroid story. I have two different sites that say completely different things.
Yeah.
How the hell am I supposed to know what's true?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have an insider at NASA. I mean, I guess in the old... I mean, it seems to me like maybe it's become too centralized. Maybe the media companies need to be broken up, or at least they need to be more localized. Because it used to be like that. There used to be newspapers all over the place.
Yeah.
But of course, they all went out of business.
Yeah.
And that was the last really local element of news.
Right.
You know?
Well, I mean, I think we still have some element of local news. I think you're just seeing it in the form of blogs and smaller publications. Gothamist.
Right, right.
DNA Info, which is broad.
Yeah, I like the Gothamist a lot.
Yeah, Gothamist is really cool.
Yeah, Brooklyn, the Post actually sometimes is totally swimming against the tide.
Yeah.
You know, like, regardless of whether you agree with them or not, you know, they're definitely not. It isn't a cookie cutter of what's on CNN or what. It isn't just an AP press release.
Yeah.
You know?
Brooklyn Eagle. You know, a lot of these cool little media companies that have cropped up in the last few years.
Right. So go to the local media companies. You think that's the answer?
It's a start.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah. I like that. That's a good answer.
Yeah.
Thanks for the encouragement. Whew. All right, we're not doomed. Well, not quite yet. We're getting there, but okay. So you know, I was. I have a question for you. It's kind of a, like, I got a personal insight from someone. You remember Slashdot, I'm sure.
Sure. Yeah,
they were one of your competitors.
Well, they weren't a competitor. Well, not so much a competitor, but definitely I participated on it. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm all about them. Wow.
I'm a 4-digit UID, man.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I was early on. I have to credit one of my peers with that for telling me about it in the early days. But yeah, I mean, but they got bought. This is not news. All right. So they got bought in 99 or 2000 or something by Andover.net. And I think it was that trend. There's been a lot of transitions to them. But I think that was the last one before Commander Taco left and all those.
Taco.
Yeah, that's his username. One of the things that I actually went to a conference, and I saw one of the executives, and I was a little worried because I really liked Slashdot. I was really involved at the time. Now it's like I just go there occasionally, poke around. Yeah. But I was like, what is more valuable to you? Is it the code that you're after, or is it the users? And they were like, oh, it's absolutely the community. The community is what we care about. It's about curation of the community. What do you think? You know, having run a website with a community, you know, having been down the same road, is it the community or is it the code?
Yeah, it's community. You can always replace the code. You can't replace the community.
So it's not a chicken and the egg. It's clearly the egg. It's screw the chicken.
It's interesting you bring up the chicken and the egg. And by the way, the answer to that question is the chicken and the egg, which came first.
Yeah.
It's the egg.
Nice.
Yes.
See, I knew that. Mm. I set the egg. 50-50 shot. I got that right. Yeah, I got it right. Why? Why is it the egg?
Well, the egg hatched the chicken, right?
Yeah.
Then it's its first chicken. What laid the egg? Proto chicken.
That's right. A Sasquatch, clearly, laid the chicken egg. Yes. The very first chicken was a Sasquatch. I'm making that up. Any particular reason why you think it's the users? I mean,
you can have all the code in the world. I mean, if you don't have people to look at your site or participate on the site with, I mean, what's the point of having the code?
Right.
I guess, if your code is so valuable that, it's doing something so fascinating and unique that it's just going to draw the same community in when it's re-implemented, then I guess that's one of those circumstances where it's fine. But,
okay, sorry. I was just checking I'm not being rude. I was actually, this is one of my trusted confidants. This story's got to be fact-checked, though, so I'm not going to talk about it. Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
No.
I encourage you, so if you know me and you have my number or my information, feel free to pop in the comments and ask questions. No problem. We'll answer them. So, of course, to some degree, the code itself shapes why users want to go there.
Sure.
Right? You know, so, I mean, like, I really love the /.meta moderation. I was like, this is going to become something great. And then, of course, you know, it's labor, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you have
yeah.
to go in there and do the work to do the meta moderation. And you got to care to do that. And if your enthusiasm wanes, and that happens, of course, the band of users, and the users leave, so then wasn't it the code's fault that the users left?
Mm.
You know, so, I mean, and not really so much what comes first, but what's more important to the perpetuation of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I guess there's no real, like, right or wrong.
No.
I don't think so. But I always remember when we would get on the front page of Slashdot, we always saw that bump in traffic. It was like the Reddit of its day.
Right, right. I got Slashdotted. Yeah, I had a server. Yeah, I actually, when I finished my book, and I, it's kind of a weird story. So I got edited by people I knew. So I said, hey, I have a book. And everyone said, this is mistakes in here. because I had just released it online. Yeah. I just wrote it and released it. Mm-hmm. I didn't have an editor. Mm-hmm. And they're like, there's mistakes in here. I'm like, well, tell me where they are and I'll fix them. And I just kept saying that, and people kept sending me. I have at home, I have a pile, I don't know, from the table, like up to here, just transcripts of the book with edits in them.
Yeah.
So it was like the first community edited book.
Yeah.
And so there was this kind of this, I don't know why I got into this. Oh, anyway, so I was bragging on Slashdot. I said, oh, I have the first community edited book. Well, first community edited fiction book, which to which someone replied, no, Wikipedia. But so maybe on the second after Wikipedia. And and I got Slashdot obliterated by servers. It was just a smoking pile of ash. And actually, I didn't even know at the time because I wasn't that versed yet in tech.
Yeah.
I wasn't that good yet.
Yeah.
Apparently there was a flaw in Apache where it could never have handled the traffic, a single machine, if I hadn't patched for this. So I was doomed from the start.
Yeah, I remember those being.
They called it slash dotting.
Yes, those were issues back in the day. You're getting knocked off the internet because you had too much traffic.
I do too. Fact check. I have URLs to all of my. Anyway, that's my answer to someone's question. Someone says, "Since when do you fact check?" I do fact check. So. Yes, actually, so I had someone challenge me on one of my stories, so I always have URLs for all of them now, so right. You can go look it up and, you know, all right, that's not what it really says, or, you know. Of course, all this stuff, good luck, you know. Yeah. I'm curious, what do you think about, do you know what the ZipF distribution is? So it's this idea, like, where it's a formula that seems to appear in nature, like you know, the Fibonacci sequence. It's like something like that, or pi, where you see it occurring a lot.
Yeah.
And one of the places it occurs a lot is in cities. In particular, New York is roughly twice the size of the next tier of cities. So, like in the United States, this is just one example. This happens in a lot of different countries, and it just happens over and over and over again. So New York is 8 million people, and then there's a tier of cities that are like 3.5 million people, 4 million people.
Right.
And there's another tier of cities, so only three of those, and there's a tier of like five or six cities,
yeah.
And there's a tier of 12 cities. And it's like it almost forms a pyramid naturally. It seems to me, like I was thinking about something, this is just completely off the wall, but I just wanted to like have a good brain on this.
Okay.
I really just wanted to. I'm curious if this is something that happens in social media and the network effect. Specifically, I was thinking about PewDiePie, and I've noticed that whatever you think about him, it doesn't matter. But he is clearly a superstar in a way that no one has ever been on the history of the earth.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got 100 million subscribers. I mean, you know, the typical ratings of a lot of news agencies are between 1 and 4 million people.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy, the reach he has is
incredible,
mind-bending.
Yeah.
And the next guy, the next group of people, as far as like social media superstars, are like almost seem to follow that ZipF formula.
Interesting. Yeah.
Right. It almost seems like it's a pyramid formula.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if this is like, why do people? Where is this coming from?
Is it wired into our DNA? Is it wired into our genetics?
Right. I mean, is this just monkey stuff where we're looking for the leader and he's top ape. Okay.
We're gonna follow him.
But then, I mean, PewDiePie is not my leader.
No.
So you know what? What? I mean, he's not bad. He's just not really my cup of tea. He's a little, but I mean, of course, to have the broadest appeal, you absolutely have to appeal to children. So, like I know this thing will just top out. We could never, sorry folks, we could never have more than a few million viewers because there's just if you don't include children in your demographic, you're never going to have it.
Yeah,
I don't really because I mean, I'm not against children. I just don't think they're going to be interested in these harder topics.
Right.
He does. You know, he plays games, so it's really like it's really accessible. Even if he talks seriously for 5 minutes, most of his. So I'm just wondering if there's something to that. If anyone has any insights on ZipF and why that happens, I'm probably mispronouncing it, but you know, when you learn things by reading, that's what happens. one of the things that happens with cryptocurrencies, and this is something that comes up, so like with doesn't come up with Bitcoin, but comes up with a lot of the other cryptocurrencies, in particular Ethereum. So Ethereum has, I don't know, do you know cryptocurrencies well, or?
Well enough, I might be able to stumble through this conversation.
Okay, all right. So I'll give you some background so okay. you know what I'm talking about. So one of the features, oh no, I did it again! I did the air quotes again. One of the features of Ethereum is that in Ethereum, you have a payload area where you can have like colored coins, and you can create like entire currency networks as a subcomponent of other coins. So you can buy a coin and make that it kind of its own economy.
Yeah.
And break it into little tiny pieces. So you get that a lot, and it actually it boosts it. But one of the disadvantages to this is you have this enormous data field where you can write all this data and put all this stuff in an Ethereum itself, in the Ethereum blockchain, which could make it slow or fast. And you can argue about whether that's good technically or bad, but I think that's a solvable problem. But the part that isn't a solvable problem, and something like Litecoin or Bitcoin, there's very little data available. And there was a thing a few years ago where someone claimed, oh, well, now we have to shut Bitcoin down because I've uploaded porn into the Bitcoin blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not really porn. It was just like a URL, essentially.
Yeah.
Right? And because the data field, the data typing was so strict.
Yeah.
But in something like Ethereum, it's not strict. So you get this kind of like this thing where you have a poison well, where you can literally put something that makes you have to change your mode of operation into the data. This is something that can happen with Git, too. And I've tried to warn businesses about this. They just laugh at me and say, that never happens. But theoretically, a disgruntled employee could upload, the Loki spirit of things, upload junk, illegal junk, into your Git. And if you don't know about it and operations proceed for a while, now you have to go back and, pull that stuff out of your Git, and you have to shut everything down while you're doing that.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, of course, in the case of Git, usually it's just a handful of people. But in the case of a cryptocurrency, you can't reverse all those transactions.
Yeah.
It's financial ruin. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just shattered current confidence in the currency. So, I was thinking about this in conjunction with what we were talking about before with like how you download one thing in a peer-to-peer system, and you end up getting something else.
Yep.
It would be disguised as something and then they solved it with the hashes, and that was one of the reasons I think this is kind of still the evolution of peer-to-peer. What do you think about poison wells, and specifically, do you see that technique being used anywhere else? Do you see this as, I guess when you're dealing with metadata, do you have to use narrow use cases all the time, or is there another way to solve this that I'm not seeing?
I don't know if there's another way to solve it.
I mean, can we just say, okay, poison wells are not valid, we don't care what junk you upload to this blockchain? This is the problem with having illegal knowledge, right? Carnal knowledge.
You're always going to have poison wells. Poison wells are like part of the culture. You're always who's going to be the poison well club, right?
Right.
There's always the poison well. People want to be the poison.
Let's have an adventure.
Right. Who wants to be in the poison well club? And
in a way, maybe even I'm probably going on way way dark territory here. But in a way, it's almost like mass shooters are part of this. They just want to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to be part of the media cycle, and they want to poison that well.
Yeah, I wonder about the psychology of that, whether that's actually a play or not. But
the Charles Manson's a superstar. Everyone's obsessed with him. There's been movies on, Natural Born Killers kind of dealt with this. Like, what is it like when killing people makes you a superstar? So it's definitely part of it. It may not be the most important part, but.
But yeah, I mean, you're dealing with a psychology at that point that it's easier.
The same thing, or?
No.
No, you don't think so.
No, I think the poison well is something that someone who is not a psychopath can maybe see themselves having a little fun with.
Right, right. There's a difference between mischief and treason, or mass murder. Right,
right. So, you're going to stop the poison wells?
Right.
No. Not until Tay and the rest of the AI...
nice Tay reference, good job.
That's always the problem.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I mean... It seems like if we could solve the poison well problem, then maybe we could, you know...
You're solving the humanity problem.
We're solving the humanity problem, right? Well, I mean, in a way, you know, it's the Byzantine general's problem is the Bitcoin is the solution to that. It's a solution to a computer science problem. And this is one of the things I tell people when they're like thinking about maybe investing in cryptocurrencies. I'm like, this is like, it's very rare that computer science problems get solved. You know, like, sure, you can implement a solution of an understood problem, but if it's a new solution, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
So this person anonymously solved the computer science problem, that's got to tell you something, that this is a seminal event. But, you know, it's only in the case where the data payload is very small, because if it gets too big, you know, I mean, can we, as a society, get to the point where we can just turn a blind eye to something that's junk mixed in with quality? Because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, oh, we're going to put legal documents on a blockchain.
Good luck.
If they're really, really strictly typed and nothing ever changes in them, maybe. But I don't know. I mean, voting seems more plausible.
I think voting might be a solution to that, right? I mean, but no, I don't know if we necessarily want to find the solution to it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we don't want to. What we want to allow a certain degree.
So you think credibility is going to be how we solve this problem? You know, like it's him. I'm going to choke his neck. He did it. He was the carrier. He was the last one to touch it.
I think it's a start.
Yeah.
I think it's already something.
I mean, that's what the legal system already does, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, you can't introduce evidence if you don't know where the hell it came from.
Right.
You're like, oh, look what fell from the sky, you know, like in Hunger Games or something, you know, a little parachute and a bell, you know, where did it come from? You know, that's right. The first thing a lawyer attacks.
Of course, the credibility. I mean, you're always going to the credibility of the evidence.
Credibility of the evidence. So it seems like, so we're in an interesting situation. So I don't know if you, I really appreciate that you have this legal background and you also understand computers. I know these are tough questions, and I'm not saying I don't have answers for these either. But thanks for entertaining me and letting me. If I'm going too far, let me know. We can get into something lighter, like biology or something. But
swing away.
In what world? Only on the Technocrat Live can you say biology's light. But I think I segued one too many times and I popped my stack and I don't know what I was talking about. Where I was going to go with this. Yes, I do. It was on my sheet. No, it's not. Oh no. All right. Well, we'll have to come back to it. I'm sure I'll think of it later. Oh yeah, with the custody chains, and so there is I did some math on custody chains, and so genetics, of course, is a huge technological change. You know, for the legal system, right? Yeah. There's been decades and decades of exonerations and convictions of previous crimes that no one knew who did what. And one of the reasons is because statistically, DNA is a good genetic match. Of course, there's the issues of whether it's the process is followed and whether it's solid or not. And you get scientists and experts talking about the actual genetic testing. But assuming the testing is good, the best case, it's something like 300 million to one.
Yeah.
That genetics is correct.
Right.
So I actually did the math, and the car crash, based on the amount of car crashes in the country, the odds that a police man or woman driving your evidence from point A to point B will crash and destroy the evidence is significantly higher than genetics.
Okay.
So genetics are actually really good.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, so you could actually trust them more than humans.
Okay.
But here's the weird part. So, and this is something that came up with the WikiLeaks stuff, but don't worry about the WikiLeaks. I just think that this is an interesting problem. What people who were in that field didn't understand is that some of the WikiLeaks emails were signed with DKIM signing. You know what DKIM is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the statistics on that are about three orders of magnitude better than genetics. So right now, digitally signing messages is the best chain of custody in the entire legal system, if you're going by odds.
Fascinating.
So I'm wondering if there's something to the poison well and to digitally signed documents. Like, is it just because the law literally says you have to have a paper document? Is that why we're not digitally signing all legal documents at this point?
You know, that's interesting, because the law actually does say that a digital copy is as good as the paper copy.
Oh, it does?
Yeah,
okay.
At least in the state of New York.
I didn't know this was settled. Okay.
Yeah, in New York it is.
Sweet. This is good info, yes.
Yeah.
I'm
going to
quote you on that. So
No, go for it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So digital copies are as good as the original. And what are the conditions of that? How does that, is there any gotcha there? Or, I mean, like, theoretically, is it a grainy photograph as I'm running by at 100 miles an hour? What's the standard for knowing that this document is as good? Because, of course, you have the deep fakes, right?
Right.
They're coming in from the side now, possibly threatening that.
So I could say, let's say there's a physical piece of paper, and I say, Matt, is this your signature? And you'll look at it, and you'll say either yes or no.
Right.
I take the digital signature, whatever condition it's in. Matt, is this your signature, yes or no?
I can't tell.
Can't tell. Well, that would be the same thing. It would be legally the same thing as you saying, is this your signature? I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Now, is that good or bad?
It depends on which perspective.
I guess this must have come up with photocopiers before, right? Or Xerox machines?
Sure.
Right? A crappy Xerox.
You're right.
Way worse than a
bad evidence. Yeah, bad evidence. Right.
Sorry, I would have warned you about this, but I had no idea we were going here either. So, yeah, I mean, it takes a ton of studying, when you're trying to come up with legal answers for stuff like this.
And now you're getting into forensics.
right. Yes. Well, this is something this is really what the Shield Act is really about, is what's your forensic responsibility? But the question is, what's your forensic responsibility for anything?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's kind of all been a hand trick. This paper's real because I say this paper's real. But we have the possibility now of verifying things in a mathematical way that really wasn't technologically possible before this decade.
Yeah.
So in a way that's better than genetics, and we treat genetics as sacrosanct rightly.
Yeah.
So I mean, at what point does digital custody? Do we need a framework for digital custody to understand when the photograph is too blurry, when the deep fake hasn't, is possible?
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Holy crap. That's a great question, and I have no answer for it.
That's a good answer.
Wow.
Yes. I stumped him.
No.
We have a stumpage. Yeah, I'm stumped too, man. I don't know the answer. Thanks, man. Yeah, I don't really know either. And I hope somebody else has an answer and somebody watches and goes, oh, I know that.
Yeah.
And then code something genius. And maybe it'll be the same singularity that coded Bitcoin. I don't know. But Satoshi, if you're out there, we need you. Come back. Satoshi, come back. We need some more code for us. All right. So I won't sing anymore, I promise. So what is RentCement?
RentCement.com.
Give you something more concrete.
Oh, wow.
Nice. You see that?
That was good.
I'm on my third cup of coffee when I can come up with puns like that.
Oh, Lord. So RentCement is a website that tries to make housing law a little bit more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Tries to make the analysis of housing more accessible and the steps that people, tenants, can take to learn a little bit more about the public resources, databases, information that's very readily available, collect that information and make a informed, smart decision about not only the place they're thinking about renting, the places they do live in, the places they already are renting.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
So how did they get? How do you get the information onto the website? Is it all pulled from public records, or?
So I know
there's some there's some level of information available in public records that maybe everyone doesn't always realize.
Yeah.
Having been through the housing process.
So RentSubmit is not a interface to the data. Slick. RentSubmit is more kind of like Slick in a way. It's an informational blog,
the community.
Community website. Discusses, say I'll go to an individual building, a building that's under construction, and I'll take a couple pictures of it, and then outline the analysis of what I would of how I would proceed to determine whether or not this building is rent stabilized or not.
Okay.
So going into the public databases that the city runs, the repository is, okay, you go to this website to see, is there some kind of agreement between the owner and the city that subjects the building to rent stabilization.
Right.
Going to another database to see how many, if any units have ever been registered as rent stabilized. Going to other databases. So you're just piecing together all these data sets to come up with, hopefully come up with some kind of answer.
Right. Okay. All right. So you're really just focused on the point at which the building itself becomes stabilized. Now, is there different kinds of stabilization? I thought there was also per apartment stabilization. In other words, a person or a family had been living in an apartment for a while, and they become stabilized because they had become regular tenants there for however many years or decades or whatnot.
Yeah.
How are they different?
So there's one rent stabilization law.
Right.
Now, there are different ways that you can get to rent stabilization.
Oh, okay. So it could be per building or per apartment.
And it's a little bit of a misnomer when I say a rent-stabilized building.
Right.
Because there's no such thing as a rent-stabilized building.
Right.
There's rent-stabilized apartments.
Okay.
And there's no such thing as rent-stabilized tenants either.
Okay.
It's a colloquialism. At this point, it's a colloquialism that everybody understands. When I say I'm a rent-stabilized tenant,
right,
everybody understands what you mean.
Right, right.
Or saying,
in an apartment which is available.
Right. Right, exactly. So, but yeah, to your point about, there's something called succession rights in rent stabilization.
Right.
Where if you live with the tenant for a certain amount of time, the tenant vacates, you now become the rent stabilized tenant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it's like a family, like a father son.
Yes.
Yeah, and the father passes away, the son, if he was living with him, would be able to apply for that.
You don't have to apply. You just are.
You just are. Oh,
you just
okay.
are. Yes.
It's a copyright. Everyone thinks you have to do something, but no, it's already copyrighted.
Yeah, now the owner might have a different perspective on that and try to evict you, but
do they curl their mustache always when they do?
They're curling something.
Oh God.
And interesting that you mentioned family, because family is a very broad term in the state of New York. It's not just biological.
Okay.
You could be living with somebody for a certain amount of time and have a family-like relationship.
So almost like a common law family?
A family, yeah. If what you mean by common law family is like having a family-like relationship, like you're intermingling funds, you do family barbecues.
I didn't mean like boinky boinky. I mean like you're around, you're making dinner, they're making dinner.
Right. Yeah.
You're in that space. It's where you live.
Right.
Yeah. How do you do? So RentSubmit is to help people to figure out whether they're eligible for this, or
not necessarily eligible. It's also a commentary. The tagline,
or what rights they have, maybe
perhaps.
Yeah.
But the purpose, the tagline of RentSubmit is where tenancy and construction meet.
Right.
So it tries to bring to light the fast pace of construction in New York and the impact that that has on tenants, how it has on tenants' rights, what it has to do with
what you're talking about.
Impact on affordability.
See, a non-New Yorker right now would be like, that seems kind of vague. I know exactly what you're talking about.
it's not just analysis and determine, because otherwise it's going to get pretty boring. Mm-hmm. But it does look at different building projects that are pretty visible in our skyline and in our communities, and hopefully give some insight in what's going on.
Right. Does it tackle like higher end tenants too? Like, I mean, like someone with a $1 million apartment about to have their view obscured in Central
park?
I tend to not. So
I mean, that would be a huge problem for them, right? You know, they have this piece, they have this place that they live, and this city's protecting them. They've been there for a while, and now they're screwed. You know, like their whole lifestyle is completely changed.
So yeah, I mean,
of something completely out of their control.
There are some wild stories.
I mean, also cranes falling on your head too. You know, there was a rash of cranes falling on people in New York. I hate to joke about it, but no. You know,
yeah, it's true. It's
funny from a distance. It's not funny when it's falling on you.
No. but there are a lot of stories about that, like zoning changes that suddenly make add into the mix a divorce proceeding between a husband and wife who
owned, gets to stay in the apartment.
Well, they owned a piece of property on the Williamsburg waterfront.
Right.
And this was right before the rezoning took place, 2000s, when the property value was maybe a few million dollars, which is still substantial money, but the divorce agreement separated $1 million, okay? And I think the agreement was one of the spouses agreed to take money, the other spouse decided to keep the property.
Okay.
Interesting move, because I think what the legal theory of one of the spouses was is that they knew that this property was, there was the rezoning was going to happen. That property suddenly went to $350 million overnight.
Wow.
So.
And that's not technically illegal, right? Because there's no insider trading laws like there is with the SEC.
No. So one of the spouses sued, even though there was really no chance of ever winning because the settlement agreement was already signed, dotted. But they had to try.
They're going to, well, a long time from now, they're still going to be fighting in hell.
But wow. That's a
yeah, yeah. No, yeah, I totally understand why they. And, I mean, also in a more down to earth, you know, getting out of the Fifth Avenue world, more down to earth, you know, one of the big problems with construction, whenever there's construction anywhere near you in New York City, rats.
Yes.
Mice.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a flood of rats whenever you start ripping stuff up because there's animals living in the nooks and crannies of other of residents. Right. Especially the bigger the building and the more people there are around, the more true it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any legal implications or if they have to pay for the extermination. I would imagine they would.
Yeah. So before you, Archer Avenue, I think Archer Avenue in Jamaica is a good example of that being rezoned and redeveloped. And you'll see, next time you go to a construction site, you'll see postings about, because you have to take care of the vermin issue before you can tear down a building.
Right.
So there's going to be old rat traps.
In theory.
Yeah. DOB is good about enforcing those laws.
Really?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. The city's
good.
On top of it.
Yeah. Really, no one wins when rats are running wild.
No, nobody wants rats running wild.
Yeah. How about one thing that's happening right now, and this is something, again, a city type thing that you wouldn't necessarily see somewhere else. Con Ed is just completely ripping apart my neighborhood. They're looking for a gas leak somewhere.
Sounds like my neighborhood.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, they're doing it everywhere.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, and it's just total mayhem. I mean, like, you can actually watch as traffic expands across all of Long Island from Northern Boulevard as you get towards 5 o'clock. You know, it's just like concentric circles expanding out. So are we off or
still going?
Okay, cool. Sorry to be skeptical. I'm going to be optimistic, I swear. I just there's got to be real consequences to legal consequences for the quality of life for people when utilities, for example, want to do work and they're disrupting everything.
Yeah.
You know, like people can't get to school, people can't get to work on time, there's nowhere to park.
Yeah.
Parking's a huge issue, right? Because you have a pretty good feel for whether you can park on your street or not, but you take half of it away for construction cones and holes dug in the ground and all of a sudden everyone's screwed.
Yeah.
So it was just the kind of thing also that you would be dealing with there or...
Not so much.
Right.
I gotta say, so I feel almost like...
I'm looking at quality of life and trying to figure out where the site fits in the quality of life.
So it fits more in where it affects maybe more lower income individuals who don't have, you know, when we start talking about being able to get to
the quality of the building itself.
Quality of the building itself, the affordability of the building itself, and how is construction going to add or deteriorate the affordable housing stock that's in New York.
Okay.
So not so much about...
It's been terrible. Well, New York is you may not know this, but New York has doubled, you know, more like in 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's enormous. Like the popularity of some TV shows, the availability of jobs, and you know, they just built tons of new housing. But of course, they don't build cheap housing.
No.
They build the high end stuff.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, they just say, well, whatever, it'll work out.
Right. Well, it's true. You know, it is very true. But it has improved under de Blasio, who has made that part of his the 5-year, 10 borough plan, which is to build 100,000 affordable units within that short period of time, which actually they've met that, they're approaching that goal, and I think they've improved, they've changed the goal to something on the order of 300,000.
Okay.
Affordable is also a relative term.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's always there's hidden costs, and of course, all right. Well, you know, I'm not going to pretend like I know more about this, but if there's it's kind of interesting, and if you might want to check it out, Rent Cement. If you're looking at looking for social support on housing issues in New York City.
Check us out. Yeah,
check it out. Also, you're part of the Norris Report on Facebook?
The Norris Report, yeah.
What is the Norris Report?
So the Norris Report is a weather blog started by my good friend Rich Norris, who began the website.
What's up?
Richie boy.
Yeah, and it's a website. Actually, it's a blog on Facebook. We're thinking about trying to get it off of Facebook and start its own.
Why? Web 2.0 is great. You're safe in the walled garden.
Yeah.
Safe from views. Safe from profit. Safe from success. Safe from controlling your own data.
Continue. Yeah. Right. No. So we're weather enthusiasts. We like discussing weather, and it has grown tremendously in popularity. To our very, very surprise, but we never really expected it to become as big as it has. Not gigantic, but 7,000 plus subscribers.
Nice.
And users, so we're pretty happy.
So what's the secret?
Good content. Good and frequent content.
Right. Is it the quality of the weather reports, the delivery, both?
So we never pretend, we're not meteorologists.
Right.
We're not scientists.
Right.
We're just two guys who like to learn.
Neither are meteorologists aren't scientists either. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. You are.
Yeah.
Sometimes you know, with hurricane tracks, people don't realize how complex tracking a hurricane is.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, you know, so we try to make that kind of information more accessible because it is complicated, and it takes hours to try to sometimes to distill something to 5 minutes.
Right.
So there's tons of data out there, and trying to get that data into something that you're going to be able to get to people because it's critical information. So that's what we try to do.
All right, great.
Yeah.
That sounds like it sounds like fun. So check that out. I'm kind of I guess aviators are inherently kind of weathermen.
Got it. Well, I took plenty of aviators.
Motorcyclists too. Actually, I ride a motorcycle.
So do I.
Oh, you do?
Yes,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, that's my bad. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
So.
Around every 20 feet, gotta ride a motorcycle.
Apparently, everyone here rides a motorcycle. Like some kind of vortex opens up at the front door if you try to walk in and you don't have a two-wheeled vehicle. I mean, you know, whenever you're taking off on a plane, you have to plan it out, because otherwise you're not going to know how much fuel you're going to need, you know, how much time it's going to take in the air.
Yeah. Critical. You don't clearly don't want to fly into a thunderstorm.
Right. Yeah. Or a hailstorm.
Right.
Or
even worse.
Yeah. Right. So what got you interested in aviation?
Oh, what got me interested in aviation? I always just thought it was cool. It was probably just wanted to fly. It was like, man, awesome. I want to fly.
Did you play flight simulators when you were?
Oh yeah, like flight simulator 2.0, man.
Nice, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I played a lot of the early ones were pretty lame. They were mostly lines and vector
right.
stuff. But yeah, it was still
but
fun.
But it kind of worked. Yeah, but it was fun.
Right. So how far did you get? What can you fly?
I can fly. I'm a certified private pilot.
Okay.
I fly single engine aircraft or flew a single engine aircraft, Cessna 172s, Cessna 152s, nothing commercial or large like that.
Nice. One of our guests actually wanted to have a jet plane, but I don't remember what the model was. She told us at the time.
Learjet?
Gulfstream? Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Gulfstream, that was
Gulfstream.
It. Yeah.
Everyone wants a G6.
Yeah. Oh, okay, there you go. Everyone wants a G6. Oh, no. Laugh with me. Yes, the benefits of working in tech. Yes. Yeah, we kind of make fun of the snootiness sometimes. Mm. It gets a little hoity-toity. I've been to some freaking fancy parties in the IT world. So, how about the lawyer world? Is it like that, or
the type of law that I practice? No,
no.
This is down and dirty, boots on the ground, getting dirty
right.
with the tenants, and
yeah, like swimming, ringing doorbells, calling people,
going into
courtrooms,
going into apartments that are you're dealing with situations where tenants are being victimized, right? Owners aren't doing the maintenance. Vermin everywhere. So
right.
If you're looking for glamour in housing, well, you're not going to find it.
Right. Well, that's great. I'm so glad you're doing that. I'm so glad that someone is that you guys are focused on this and helping people in that way. And I just I never would have imagined that is kind of like a noble Robin Hood thing. It just didn't cross my mind, but it kind of is.
Yeah, it is.
You guys are kind of like the heroes of Sherwood Forest.
A little bit. It's up and down.
Fighting the man.
It's up and down. Some like last week, it's just like nothing went right. And then this week, like, people were just... dealing with owners is funny, man. Like, and this week, it was like I was getting everything I wanted. It was as if somebody gave me the Thor's hammer of power, right? And, and it was like I was given all this power for over an issue. And I was like, I had to sleep on it. I was like, how am I supposed to something that is just a hugely impactful piece of power I was given
right.
by the owner. It's like we'll do anything you want. I'm like, what?
Right.
This hardly ever happens, but here I was, and it was.
Oh, he just does that. You know, okay. He just crawls around sometimes. It's some kind of LARPing, I think. So
it's difficult. It's difficult to handle that sometimes.
There's a show behind the scenes somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I like to joke with our audience that they missed the whole Steve show that we get treated to. So there's like jumping around and hand waving and hand signals and
some parkour.
Yep. He's like, bored. I'm gonna work out. What was the licensing like for flying a plane? I mean, like, how many hours did you have to get in? I know it's done by hours, right?
Yeah. Yes, a certain minimum of hours. Not nearly as hard as law school.
Really? Okay. So
I think law school and probably a lot of professions put undergrad and that kind of thing.
Where's the furthest place you've ever flown? Oh my God. Flown.
No, not too far. I've flown up to Maine.
Okay.
Yeah. Keeping it northeast. I've never flown across country or anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. I assume you rent a plane or how does that work?
Yeah, you rent a plane. Back when I used to fly a lot, it used to be cheap.
Right.
Yeah. So we used to fly up to Maine, Provincetown, get some lobster.
Driving to Philly to get a Philly cheesesteak.
Yeah, right. I think I was more motivated to. I love aviation. I think it's really cool.
Right.
But I don't think it was ever my passion.
Right.
Not like Slick was and investigating and dealing with housing issues.
Right.
It was cool. It was a cool thing to do.
You ever watch Better Call Saul?
Sure.
Oh,
But not really. Not religiously. I kind of.
So this is spoilers. Sorry, just tune out for 1 minute. So there's this great scene with Saul later on in his career. You can even say kind of post career, and he just sees some kid getting arrested for shoplifting, and he doesn't want to like piss the cops off. because he's hiding. Mm. But he just can't take it. At one point, he's like, kid, you got rights. You can do this. You can do that. Don't let him railroad. You call a lawyer. Da, 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 da. And then he goes, and then the cops look at him like, you dick. And I was like, yeah, okay, I kind of get it.
Yeah. No, yeah. I've had circumstances
you're
like
passionate.
That. No, I've...
Just, I got to help you.
I
can't let this happen to you.
I've had circumstances where I've had to...
Right, right.
Where I've seen people...
Well, I think that's the definition of how to make yourself a good guy, right? Yeah. You know, because people... Otherwise, like, the justice system can't work unless everybody's at least got a fair shot.
Yeah.
Right? Because what is it detecting otherwise? Right. Who has more money?
Right.
You know, yeah. You ride a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I ride a motorcycle. What kind of motorcycle do you ride? Do you have one right now?
I do. A Honda Shadow 750.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Do you commute to work on it at all? Or?
No, I don't commute to work on it. I just
are you, in Manhattan or are you in Brooklyn? Or?
I live in Queens.
You live in Queens,
office
right?
Is in Manhattan.
Oh, you're going to Manhattan, okay.
Yeah. So, but
I used to ride in Manhattan with my bike, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I used to ride to school, law school all the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But work, it's just like I like to just be on, I think it's more relaxing just to be, sometimes just be on the train and just zone out for a while.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me it was easy because I was working right over the 59th Street Bridge, so mm-hmm. I just zip over the bridge, park, and I'm done.
Yeah.
So you know, like Manhattan itself is that's an easy way to die, you know, or at least actually no, let me rephrase that. You probably won't die because no one's going fast enough.
Yeah.
You're just gonna get hurt and your bike's gonna get messed up and you have to call the cops and fill out paperwork and you know.
Yeah, you know, I think with riding a motorcycle, you're always mentally on, right?
Mm-hmm. You have to be,
right?
Or you're dead.
It's not like driving a car where you kind of go into autopilot,
right?
Or where you're on a subway, we could definitely be on autopilot. You're always laser focused,
right? Right.
You can because you're always looking, right? I just feel like sometimes with anybody would feel this way with intense work, but you know sometimes you just gotta get on the bus on the train and
we could fall asleep on the train.
Yeah.
You know.
Decompress.
You know, like your brain, like eventually your subconscious just figures out, okay, when I hear the bell 8 times, that's my stop. You know, and you just you ever do that?
Yeah, like, it's amazing how that
you
works.
Just,
yeah.
You just you're like. Oh, look, I'm here.
Yeah?
How did that happen?
That's wild, right? Wild. Somebody's paying attention in there.
Yeah. One of the people in my head. Yeah, okay, cool. So you had mentioned that you were interested in alien life, specifically in, like little green aliens. Woo-hoo! No, I'm just kidding. The possibility of any life.
Yeah.
On celestial bodies or other planets or... So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think we're definitely within our lifetimes we're going to find significant evidence that I don't know if we're going to design a probe that's going to go to a certain celestial body with a microscope and actually find a cell, but I think we're going to get to the point where within an umpteenth degree of metaphysical certitude we'll be able to find life on other celestial bodies.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I assume you're talking about like carbon-based, carbon-water-based
microbial.
Oxygen or carbon dioxide, or maybe the reverse.
Right.
You know, carbon dioxide in and oxygen out, you know.
Or ammonia based if we're talking about Titan. But,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're open to other, you know, a little further on either side of the bell curve.
Yeah.
I think also silicon, that's a possibility.
Silicon, I think the combination of silicon ammonia and silicon, so that possibility could work on Titan because it's just so freaking cold there.
Right.
But I think on a warmer body such as Europa, or we're definitely going to find life.
Well, that would be some kind of irony, right? So we find life, and we get along great, but we can't actually ever be in the same room with them because we'll poison each other.
I think what you're going to find on Europa is going to be remarkably similar to life on Earth.
Really?
Yeah, at the microbial level.
Wow,
yeah.
In our solar system.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So Europa's the moon, one of the moons of
Jupiter.
Jupiter, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in case you didn't know that. So now, so that's something we would definitely know for sure if we went there because we'd have a physical sample.
Yeah.
It wouldn't just be doing spectral analysis on gases.
Right.
So when we're talking about that planet before, basically, they're looking at the light bouncing off the planet, and they're hoping the new telescope will be enough so they can actually look through the edge of the atmosphere and look at that refraction to tell what kinds of gases are in there.
Right.
But that's as close as we get without leaving the solar system.
Yeah.
You know, except for maybe Europa.
Maybe Europa. Do I think we're going to get on the surface? Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, that's, you know, talking 40, 50 years away from now, but we'll find it. It's there.
Yeah, so what do you think about intelligent life? What do you think the odds are that it's in the universe? Have you done a logical exploration of this? So here, I'm gonna give you an out, and then you can give you. So I'm not looking to, like, you know, the is Area 51 really filled with crashed alien ships? Who cares? It doesn't really matter. Yeah. What I'm interested in is, like, if there's intelligent life and if there's faster than light travel, in other words, they can get here quickly.
Yeah.
It would stand to reason they probably have already found us, and they're probably already here.
Right. Right.
Right.
The Cylons are already here, absolutely.
Right, right. So, like, you know, they don't necessarily be on the surface of the planet. Maybe they're just outside of sensor range. Mm. Like, if they're ahead of us, right? Because if you just roll the die and, like, say, okay, where planets are going to develop at different times, some of them are going to develop after us. It's like the thing with the singularity, and the point at which computers could support a singularity is the most likely place a singularity would appear,
yeah,
or shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
And as you get further away from that, it becomes less and less likely. It's other problems. So if faster than light travel is possible, they're probably already here.
Yeah.
Because the odds are we're right, just rolling the dice, we're probably right in the middle of the life curve of the expansion of the universe.
Right.
And therefore, some of them will have been before us, and we'll have noticed that this planet could support life, just like we're noticing on, I don't remember the name of the planet.
K2-18b?
Yeah, K2-18b.
Yeah.
Right, so, like, they noticed us, like, we noticed K2-18b, and they said, okay, let's go there. And they said, yep, there's something happening here.
Yeah.
And they just hung around and waited just outside. You know, not everybody. Not the entire alien race is sitting in a mothership,
sure,
waiting to kick our butts.
Right.
I mean, maybe. Right? You know, like, they use nuclear weapons on their own planet. Maybe they're coming for us. Hopefully that's not what they're thinking.
Right.
Right, right.
But I go back and forth on that.
Right.
I go back and forth on it. So part of me is like, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But then a part of me is like, how would you ever know? How can we, with the technology that we have, as you were getting at, would you ever know? How do you know I'm not?
How do we know we're not in a simulation?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if it's sufficiently advanced, if the computers are sufficiently large,
yeah,
I mean, they could just, you know, we could be inside a program.
Yeah.
And isn't the system administrator God, right? Or the aliens, could they be God? Or, like, you know, so this is, I kind of laugh when people are like, all right, so there can't possibly be anything supernatural, or there can't possibly, because there's this whole realm of questions where you talk about the simulation theory, like the advanced holodeck, where you're in it all the time, either completely encapsulated inside your mind,
yeah,
or you're a program inside of a, or you're physically in something, probably not physically in something, that would be the hardest to do.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like that and aliens sitting at the periphery of our ability to see them, and a supernatural deity or supernatural deities, a la the Greeks, you know, or the Romans, you know, they had the gazillion gods and they're all fighting all the time, Loki and Thor, you know, right? So Marvel did. I love the Marvel movies just because of that, because it helped open people up to the possibility of, okay, they're just really powerful and live really long and have really advanced technology.
Yeah.
They look like gods to us, but they're just...
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of all the same problem, right? It's hard to be an anti-theist, you know? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, it's just arrogance when you're sure that something's not real, that you can't tell whether it is or not, right? So, like, then... If we have intelligent life at the periphery, the real question becomes, what do we have to do before they trust us? I think that has really awesome implications for humanity.
Yeah.
Like, what is our test? They're waiting for us to do something.
Yeah.
Whether it's get real about something. I mean, there was a really funny Twilight Zone where they were, a Twilight Zone where there was aliens were waiting at the periphery, and then they came down to Earth and said, you guys have done a terrible job, you've got 24 hours to fix it. And then all the world leaders met at the UN, and they made a universal world peace I said, no, you were bred for war. You're supposed to kill each other. You're terrible warriors. And they destroy the earth.
But
I don't think that's it, right? That's kind of ridiculous, right? But because we would be terrible warriors. Who the hell would have bred us for war?
Right.
You know, we're great at killing each other sometimes, and sometimes not so much. We're like, hey, let's just get along.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I
there's plenty of contrary evidence in evolution about that, too, so. Yeah. But, like, I don't know. What would be the criteria? You know, Star Trek has it as a warp field.
Yeah.
We can build a warp drive. Okay, the Vulcans show up. You're in.
Yeah.
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 Congratulations, you made it. You know.
Yeah, the warp drive was it, right?
So
what's going to be our test, right?
What's our test?
I don't know, because you know one of the problems I have with the whole intelligent life theory is that it imports our thinking into something that we barely know what's outside our own atmosphere, let alone how another alien organism is even at the microbial level is going to look like, let alone how another alien is going to think.
Yep.
How can you import human psychology into something not only foreign?
Oh, we can do it. It'll just be terrible and misdirected and wrong.
It's just right.
We project faces on inanimate objects as children. You know, like we.
Which is exactly that's the right way. We're projecting our faces into the universe, and that's not going to work.
Right, right.
What you're thinking?
But that doesn't mean they're not real. It doesn't mean they don't want something from us. Or they're not at least waiting. You know, maybe they don't want something, but they're just like, hey, let's see if they can join the club. What would be the criteria?
I don't know. It's like,
you know, like, is there like a universal paradigm of truth that we would all adhere? I mean, I love your I don't knows. You know, it just shows your level of education and intelligence and thoughtfulness.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, just take a wild guess. What would it be? You know, would it be treating each other well? Some kind of economic system?
I don't.
You can say you don't know. It's fine.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
Right.
But I do want to answer your question.
Good answer. Keep going.
I would say that the test would probably be something along the lines of being able to be show that you're human.
Really?
Yeah.
Like empathy?
No.
No.
What does it mean to be human? What are you? What are you?
Oh. So.
What is your role here?
He's calling Descartes on you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure I'm human. So, you know, I think therefore I am.
Hmm.
So then again, I could just be a simulation in your program. So I don't know.
Assuming you're not.
I just pulled myself out of the box.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, maybe if you were the alien in that case, you know, it would be maybe you'd be a figment of my imagination, just like you were saying, right? So which side of the glass am I on? I don't know.
I struggle, any answer I give you is just
gonna
I feel it's just not gonna be adequate. I don't know.
So I like the warp drive one. That's an excellent.
I do.
It's a fun science fiction.
It's a fun science fiction answer.
You know, like a crap. Well, because that's a very pragmatic one.
Yeah.
I like that Roddenberry used that.
Right.
Because like, oh crap, they're coming here anyway.
Yeah.
We may as well make nice with them. Maybe they'll be an ally.
Right.
We don't want them to side with the Klingons, right? So that's kind of like the really like, okay, crap, they got off.
Yeah.
Now we have to friend them. You know, it's like a friend request, right? Humans have given the Vulcans a friend request. All right.
What was the test back? Oh, I forget. It's a very famous sci-fi movie from the 50s. With the iron, the robot, the iron.
Oh, yes, Iron Man. The one they redid it recently with. Was it Keanu Reeves?
Maybe.
Yeah, I know, like, the one you're talking about.
It's like you guys have 24 hours to. It was similar, but it was like to make peace and
get rid of
nuclear weapons.
Yeah, take me to your leader, and it was I don't remember either, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. So the test was making peace.
Right.
So.
The Twilight Zone was a tongue in cheek. I don't really.
Right.
That's probably not it. They'd just kill us. They wouldn't give us a chance. They if it was war all along, they just would kill us.
Mm.
You know, which is maybe evidence that they're not here at all, because, you know, these guys are crazy.
Why not just finish us off already? Yeah. What are you waiting for?
Yeah.
Even if we detected you, who cares? What are you going
to
do? What are
Don't
we going
to listen
do?
To him, okay? We'll work something out. Yeah, they're waiting until none of us do that, right? To turncoat on the whole species just to save their own butt.
Right.
Like, okay, when no man will sell the moon anymore, that's when we'll come down here.
Gosh.
Yeah. I don't know how to
share your technology.
Measure that, but that's a pretty good one, right?
That is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, thank you so much for being on my show.
It was
Do you
great
have anything
to
you want to ask me or, you know, anything that's... We should have covered that I didn't, that I missed.
Well, we covered a lot, that's for sure. Do I have any questions for you? Where do you see the Technocrat Live in a year from now?
Hundreds of subscribers, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
So I really hope so. And if not, I may do it anyway because I'm having fun.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a business model.
Mm-hmm.
I really just want to make people aware you're in a technocracy and the decisions that people are making for you matter. And it matters more every day as the computers creep into every little thing that you do.
Yeah,
it's affecting your society. It's affecting civilization.
Yeah,
it's changing evolution.
Yeah,
we're there. Yeah. It's definitely changing evolution now.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, I'm a cyborg pirate. Arr, look at me, I'm staring at my cell phone. Yeah, big difference.
Yeah,
than 10 years ago.
Oh yeah,
is that a fair answer?
I think that's very fair.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you
very
much.
On again.
Absolutely.
Would you like to be on a panel?
Sure.
All right.
You can get me on a panel.
So that sounds great. Check out your websites. What were they again?
Slick.com with a Y, SLYCK.com. You got rentcement.com, and you can check us out on the Norse Report on Facebook.
Tom Menecki. Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.